Khan reminded me, Kelly is a tribute, not a roast, which I think limits the entertainment value all the way around Congress. But with that, I am delighted to introduce our first speaker, Cindy Estrada, Vice President, UAW. Cindy.
I need to tell you what an honor it is to be here to honor such an incredible, important man. Congressman Dingell has been a great friend to the UAW and to all workers, not just UAW workers, but we know that of Congressman Dingell, that to all workers in the state of Michigan and other states, he's been a true friend. And it's my honor as a new leader in the UAW to be here to speak, you know, about what he means to our union on behalf of President Keene as well. You know, what is there to say about a man who I think has touched so many different groups of people, introducing such important legislation that deals with children, like health insurance programs and the environment and Civil Rights Act, which, as far as I'm concerned, is the first Latina leader and vice president in UAW. I wouldn't be here had it not been for the important work that you've done. And what you've done during the auto crisis. There's not a day that doesn't go by that we're all not grateful coming out of this last round of negotiations. And had it not been for the leadership of John Dingell, we probably wouldn't have companies today here in Michigan. I would not. I very tough negotiations with suppliers because they would have no one to supply. So I want to thank you. And some days it's difficult, but I always thank you, John. And, you know, one of the things I want to talk about, being a new leader to the UAW, I've always known of Congressman Dingell. I've met him, you know, before I was vice president. I'm not sure if he remembers, but I worked in Region 1A, and Bob King, our president, was the director. And I've always looked up to him and admired him. I remember my grandmother, who comes out of GM, talking about the work that he did in the state of Michigan. But I have to tell you, just on a personal note, I've been in rooms as a new leader, and it's been Congressman Dingell who's come across the room, doesn't know me, but knows that I'm new, and knows the position I'm in, and has always reached out to me. And there's just, and the way that he talks to you, and that he just instills confidence in you, and always reminds me that this is a job that I can do. Always reminds me about the important work that I'm doing on behalf of working people, and then always reminds me that his door, and I believe him, is always open to come and talk to him, to be mentored by him, and I really appreciate that. And he's already, I've already met with Debbie and been mentored by her, and so what he doesn't know is I'm going to take him up on those lunches probably a little bit more than me. Bargain for. I really need your help. So, but really, I think what Congressman Dingell reminds me of is where we need to go back to. You know, I often sit across the important work that he's done on health care. I sit across the table in negotiations and see what a difficult task it is to negotiate contracts when the burden on health care is so much on companies today and so much on the families, the working, you know, the workers in the plant. It's a shared burden. And, you know, I'm so excited to be able to work together with him and the important work that he's done and the work that we're going to do around health care. And so I want to thank you for that. I want to thank you for the stage that you've set for my 2 8-year-old boys that, you know, I hope become just half of the men than the man that you've been. But most importantly, someone in the Detroit community, a woman, Grace Fox, who works in the civil rights movement, often talks about this as an opportunity, a time in our country where we can grow our souls. And I think what she means is these are such trying times where there's such division in politics, and workers are pitted against each other in different factions. And what Congressman Dingell reminds me of is who we need to go back to becoming. You know, we need to remember what his career and what his legacy is about. That it's about all workers. It's about all people. No matter whether you're children, no matter whether you're seniors, no matter whether you have a job or you don't have a job, is that we're here to make sure that all of us look out for each other. And when I think of John Dingell, that's what I think of, and that's the kind of leader that I want to be. And so I just feel very honored to be here to honor you. And so thank you for allowing me to do that. And thank you on behalf of your guys.
Congressman Dingell, I think it's great that three of the first four speakers tonight are women. I did not know you had a reputation as a ladies' man, but clearly you do in a good way. I'm delighted to introduce our next speaker, Lana Pollack, the chair of the U.S. section, the International Joint Commission, and former Michigan legislator.
Good evening. It is so good to be here. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And,
no.
Many old friends, maybe the emphasis on the old, like in a room for a change where there's some people here who are older than I am. Like, woo! That was really very good. First I want to say, Kelly, you're better than no one. We're still here. Yeah, no, you're right. And no one is fine, but now that I'm no longer running for office and don't have to go to the editorial board, I can say what I want. We're here to honor one of the great men in Michigan history, really in United States history. He is an icon. But I was told to humanize this thing. I never thought that John Lincoln would even write a humanizing book. So I'm going to tell you everything I'm going to say is true. First of all, I'm going to talk very briefly. A very long story is the story of the modern environmental movement. Back to Rachel Carson and John Dingell. This country, and indeed the world, would be different. A dirtier place, but for the work that John did successfully, usually in the majority, sometimes in the minority. And I think that too is an important point. Because, you know, he is a powerful guy. You are a powerful guy. You know that. I'm going to tell you a story about this, but, you know, talk about terror. Yeah. Strike terror in your hearts. Kelly, that's true. But, you know, it's not easy. He puts it together, vote by vote, with an intuition, history, and intelligence. And here's just some of the things this man has done. He was a prime sponsor of the 1972 Clean Water Act. And the 1990 update of the Clean Air Act. I know you don't all work in environmental issues, but these are important. This changed the direction of the way we, of businesses and everybody else operates in this country. He helped push through the Endangered Species Act of 1973. Law is one of the reasons that the icon of America, the bald eagle, is back. But also, and I sometimes would like to sit down with you and ask you if you recognized at the time the impact and the use that that would ultimately have. And that act is it. He was key in strengthening the Safe Drinking Water Act in 1986 and again in 1996. Yesterday, he was down at the Detroit River, our river, and he was cutting the ribbon on a new major addition to the International Wildlife Refuge in Trenton, a new gateway. It's pretty emotional. To know that, that part of the river that was always saved is saved, and that which we thought would never be able to be brought back is being brought back with wetlands and natural areas and cleanup and John Dingell's leadership. There are many more laws, many more programs, but no one in American history has this record. He does it from his heart. I mean, you know, I don't shoot things, forgive me, John. But you know, I, yeah, I just picture him having a big mud when he's next to a duck blind. Nice little things would fly over there, and I hear he's a pretty good shot. And he used to do it with their friend Bill Ford, and doing it for a long time with a lot of people. It's been privileged to do it with you. It comes from the heart, it comes from the soul, it comes from your dad, it comes from who you are. And you've shared it with all of us and with the country. And in setting an example, you've shared it with the world. So thank you. Now, John is a human being.
That's true.
Sometimes he even loses. Not often, thank goodness. Sometimes he does. One night in my history, he's probably forgotten it because it didn't mean that much to him, but John had decided he had a little lapse, just a little lapse in judgment. You know, everybody can have a lapse in judgment once in a while. He had not endorsed me in the primary. I remember that, John. I remember that even when I endorsed you in a primary. But John remembers, you know, the last night, nice thing you've done to him, and he's done me a few good turns as well, which I don't forget. But one night I did play him on that aisle, the Dingle organization, the public organization. Now, I know smart money would have been on the Dingle organization in the 15th district. We got you to a draw. It was, we caught you to a draw, and that's one of my, he doesn't remember, one of my prior moments of organizational prowess. But I wouldn't bet against Dingle in the future. And then I remember one other time. I was in his office, and John's sitting with about three staff, the chairman was sitting, with about three staff behind him. And I'm sitting with about, across the table, with about six or eight people who are encouraging him to do something. He's probably going to do it anyway, or else if he doesn't see the reason he's not going to do. You know, we're sitting there talking. There's a clock above him, just like that light I'm looking at. My eyes, for a nanosecond, glanced up the clock. I mean, just like blinks. The chairman says, "Lana, is there someplace else you'd rather be?" Terror, Kelly, terror. I said, "Oh no, Mr. Chairman, there's no place I'd rather be than here with you." And that's the way I feel this evening. Thank you so much.
No one's looking at the clock, Congressman. No one's looking. There are a couple things. Now, Wikipedia is a wonderful and dangerous thing. So I learned a couple things about Congressman Dingle that were new to me. They may be new to you. I did not know he was not a native Michigander. Born in Colorado Springs, correct? He actually was a lawyer in private practice. A research assistant to U.S. Circuit Court Judge Theodore Levin. Those Levins and those Dingles, they're omnipresent, are they not? A congressional staffer, a forest ranger, putting out more fires at the time than you started. Although once in Congress, my guess is started more fires than you put out, you think? And a prosecuting attorney, assistant prosecuting attorney for Wayne County until 1955, when he won a special election to succeed his father, John Dingle Sr., who died in office. He won his first full term in 1956, and he's been reelected 26 times since then. Absolutely amazing feat, Congressman. Absolutely. Combined, he and his father have served that area of Southeast Michigan for more than 75 years. And Republican, Democrat. I am delighted to bring up the first but not the only Republican who has high accolades for you. It is my honor to introduce Paul Milligan, Senior Vice President of Corporate Affairs, DTE Energy.
Thank you, Kelly, and good evening. Mr. Chairman, Republicans love you too. It truly is a special privilege to be able to pay tribute to a person whose public service has been a source of admiration and inspiration in my own life journey and the life journeys of many others in public service. Over 35 years ago, I worked on Capitol Hill as Congressman Philip Rupi's chief of staff. In fact, I go so far back that one of my friends and then Senator Robert Griffin's office was an energetic young Republican named Debbie Inslee. And more on Debbie later. Back then, Congressman Dingell had not yet ascended to the chairmanship of the Committee on Interstate and Foreign Commerce, but he already was one of the most influential and for executive branch administrators on the receiving end of his oversight hearings, one of the most feared members of Congress. We young staffers didn't see John Dingell as an angry partisan, though. What triggered his wrath were those instances when truth was being compromised or when government wasn't working well for the American people whom he and his colleagues represented. What we did see was a skilled and courageous legislator. When you visit Congressman Dingell's office today, you'll find a portrait that hangs over the door of his personal office. It's from the cover of a National Journal edition that featured an article on the Congressman's accomplishments. He is pictured bent over a chessboard, gazing intently, a very apt pose for a man who tackled complex issues confronting society, civil rights, health care, the environment, energy, and so much more. In a process that sometimes required decades of debate, he has guided, cajoled, and led his fellow members in resolving these issues in ways that will transcend our lifetimes. In 1981, John Dingell became chair of what is now the House Energy and Commerce Committee, the first and oldest standing committee in the U.S. House of Representatives, established in 1795. Nearly 40% of the legislation that Congress considers passes through this committee. But jurisdictional power is not what defined Chairman Dingell. Fueled by his love for this great nation, its people, and natural resources, he has shaped history. The U.S. Capitol Historical Society has described his tenure as chairman as the Dingell era. The society noted that by force of his personality, the power of his ideas and passion of his commitment, he influenced government structure and direction and national policies in ways that few legislators have matched. This assessment came alive for me when I attended the celebration of John Dingell's 50 years of service in the House. It was a magical evening to hear a history-shaping group of bipartisan leaders like former President Bill Clinton, civil rights leader and Congressman John Lewis, the late Senator Edward Kennedy, former Speaker of the House Dennis Hastert, and on behalf of then-President Bush, Vice President Dick Cheney, all praise his service and legacy was an extraordinary affirmation of what we in Michigan treasure about this true public servant. Indeed, we know well the measure of John Dingell. He has never lost his common touch or forgotten his primary responsibility of working for the people of his district and our state. In my years at Detroit Renaissance and more recently at DTE Energy, I have come to see close up the loyal service of John and Debbie Dingell to the communities of his congressional district, the Detroit region, and all of Michigan. Debbie's leadership on the Wayne State University board and countless other nonprofit boards, John's tireless advocacy for the Detroit River International Wildlife Refuge and our home state auto industry have truly enhanced our quality of life and boosted our economy. If I may, a personal aside about John's beloved partner, Debbie. I was reminded firsthand of the Dingle core value of loyalty when Debbie postponed her service as an elected Wayne State governor because she refused to be nominated in a strong Democratic year, knowing that she would defeat a Republican friend who had worked with her on Capitol Hill many years ago. And I still lost. My assigned task this evening was to speak to the business community, and so I will conclude by citing what it has meant for the congressman to balance his advocacy for economic vitality and our natural environment. It's fair to say the Clean Air Act and subsequent amendments championed by John Dingell have required DTE Energy to spend billions of dollars on coal plant emissions controls. But it's also true that over the past 35 years, we, as other utilities, have reduced particulate emissions by over 90% and sulfur dioxide and nitrogen oxide by more than 70%. At the same time, we've increased generation capacity by 45%. John Dingell has fought for a cleaner, healthier environment for the people he represents. But he's also listened to the business community when we've advocated for standards that are aligned with available technology and can be deployed over a reasonable time frame. And over, for more than 50 years, he has pursued this kind of problem-solving compromise across partisan lines. Tonight we celebrate not just what Congressman Dingell has accomplished, but how he has achieved and continues to achieve his successes. It is his servant leadership, placing people and problem-solving ahead of narrow partisanship or ideology, that in these polarized times is perhaps John Dingell's greatest gift to us and what will be his greatest legacy.
You know, Paul, you were assigned to talk about energy and you flipped into environment all of a sudden. You took over for Lana. I like that. I am delighted to introduce our next speaker, Cynthia Wilbay. She is the Vice President of Government Relations for the University of Michigan. Cynthia. Kelly's synthesis, not mine.
Sorry.
To be sure. Okay. Thank you. It's terrific to be here with everybody.
Didn't work.
I think several speakers have said it. I'll say it again. Celebrating an icon, a Michigan icon. I'd like to begin my remarks by thanking the Michigan Political History Society for their foresight in organizing this tribute, albeit a little later than Kevin Kelly had in mind, to organize a tribute to John Dingell. Congressman John Dingell, I'm honored to be a part of this program and recognize the daunting task all of the distinguished speakers have in paying tribute to the body of work and the man that stands as such an iconic figure in Michigan's political history. I want to focus most of my remarks today on the impact John Dingell has had on education. You've already heard that his primary committee, his only committee, has been that of service on the Energy and Commerce Committee, but his impact on education has been equally profound. But as I begin, I want to recall a typical mid-February day in 2010. It was a weekend. Gray, overcast, dirty snow on the streets, and plenty of brightening about an already long, long winter. But inside a nearby University of Michigan campus establishment, University of Michigan College Democrats were gathering for their annual pancake breakfast. It was a fundraiser, always held to replenish the coffers in anticipation of the election season ahead. But this was no ordinary pancake breakfast. As the event was to serve as the place where John Dingell, in his 27th term,
in the U.S. House of Representatives was about to announce that he would seek re-election for another term. The place was teeming with young adults, older admirers and supporters, and plenty of media. No one does media better than John Engel. What struck me about that Saturday morning in February, and still remains as a vivid image today, is the sheer affection and respect that so many students in that room held for John Dingle. The excitement was palpable and remarkable. Students jumping for the chance to shake his hand, to have a picture taken with John Dingle. They were leading the way and cheering the formal announcement that John was eager to put up his record for review and approval in November of 2010. They believed in the opportunities that he championed and that waited ahead for each of them in the years ahead. You've already heard from the previous speakers about the prolific legislative accomplishments, the sheer persistence and, yes, force of nature that John Dingle has applied to so many vexing issues and the many public amenities that his work has helped to improve, not only in Michigan, but across the country. But now back to education. Did you know that the 15th Congressional District is rivaled by very few in the country for the number of students in higher education institutions? The 15th is home to the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor, Eastern Michigan University, the University of Michigan Dearborn, Washtenaw Community College, Monroe Community College, Wayne County Community College, and Henry Ford Community College, as well as Concordia University and a branch of Cleary University. There isn't anywhere he can go where there isn't an educational institution nearby. And he shows all of them the same kind of care and attention. Steadfast in his belief that one of the keys to prosperity for our country is a skilled and educated workforce, John Dingle has stood tall in supporting educational opportunities for students from preschool through to their career. We all know that education is a fundamental building block for future economic and societal success. The work to achieve the fundamental opportunities for that success to occur never stops, and neither does John Dingle. Whether focused on K-12 higher education or workforce training, the record of leadership speaks for itself. His constituents and his colleagues, and most especially a colleague who believed deeply in the promise of education, Bill Ford, all knew where he stood when it comes to the importance of education. And that is nowhere clearer when he visits a school or college campus. I have seen it. America's competitiveness, he has said, depends on a highly skilled workforce, and higher education is critical to maintaining that competitiveness. From the students it educates to the innovation and research that unfolds and inspires every single day. Many of you who know John Dingle well have heard him ask you, what is it that my staff and I should be doing to be helpful to you or your organization, or just as frequently? Am I meeting your needs? I have to confess, it's a question that I often struggle to answer, because I can't really think of something he isn't doing. This, in my judgment, is an open invitation to engage in problem solving. I love that about John Dingle. Finally, I want to say something specifically about John Dingle, the teacher.
If I get up here, man.
Yes, that's right, I'm the teacher.
I'll get up, I'll
say. Although you won't see that on his bio or his resume. Many in this room have a long relationship with John Dingle, some longer than others. But what you don't see in this room, at least in significant numbers, are the hundreds of individuals who have worked side by side with him, the eager new staff members
who joined a veteran congressman staff just fresh out of college. There were a few of those in this room. The high school student who applied and was accepted to become a U.S. House page. Or a seasoned Capitol Hill operative who helped to staff the powerful Energy and Commerce Committee. Or the college student whose first real job is working on an election campaign. I hope that somewhere in the archives of a 58-year history in Congress, the hundreds of individuals who have worked for John Dingell is recorded. It is this group that has had the front row seat to Congressman Dingell, the teacher. Ask them, and they will tell you what they learned, how much they learned, and why those lessons will forever be a part of their education. It's a pleasure to join all in this room and beyond in recognizing my friend, this political icon, John Dingell.
Thanks, Cynthia. And Congressman, I know this isn't supposed to be a roast, but I heard how many universities are crammed into your district, and I thought, this poor guy can't get a break. His wife is the trustee at my alma mater, Wayne State University, which means the poor man can't even roll over without getting a higher education message. So I really, he's laughing. It's okay, people. He's laughing. They're all worried about that. All right, it is my pleasure, Corbin has to follow that. It is my pleasure to introduce Ishmael Ahmed, who is now the Associate Provost for Integrated Learning and Community Partnerships again at the University of Michigan Dearborn campus. Ish.
What a great honor this is. I've lived a long life, but I have to say that I've never had a privilege such as this one. I call John Dingell the Great One. When I see him, I say, "Hi, Great One." And the other says, "Call me John." And I know that John is a man who is one of the most powerful human beings on earth. I mean, you look at our great country and the power that exists in our legislature and the power that people like John hold. But I don't call him a great one for that. I know that John has fought for so many important things in all of our lives. Healthcare, didn't let that go until there was some victory for all of us. You know, civil rights from the very beginning, and he maintained the road until he made progress and fights to hold on to it. Environment, and yet, those are important to all of us, but that's not why I call him great one either. Because John Dingell is a man of the people, in a real sense. And I don't mean the powerful people. I mean, everyday working people like my parents. My father worked at the Rouge. My mother was a homemaker. And they commonly went to Congressman Dingell's office. They didn't even know what Congressman was, but his office was there helping them when I was a young man in the Army to give word to me during the Vietnam War. Let me make it clear, it was not in Vietnam. But during that period, they talked to that office to make sure that I was okay and people were watching out for me. John, you didn't even know that. I call him a great one because of his sense of community. You know, I did a small political stint a few years ago, and I learned a great lesson. It's not easy. All of you were, most of you work in politics in one form or another. The abuse that people often heap on you while you're trying to do good. The unfair things that are said and done when you try to do good. And Congressman Dingell has not been given a free get-out-of-jail card either. But, you know, he told me one day that I was talking to him about running the Department of Human Services. And you don't remember this either, but you were very convincing. You said, you know, if you do one small thing, maybe get people a little more money for food, or make some other small thing that makes a difference, you can help millions of people. Think about that, millions of people. John Dingell has helped millions of everyday working people who don't even know his name, who don't know anything about politics. But he has safeguarded their lives, their families, and their future. That's why I call John Dingell a great one. He's done something that I see every day. And I'm specifically going to talk about the community I come from, but it's true of all kinds of communities, and that's the Arab American community. You know, Debbie is on the board of Access, the largest Arab American organization in the country, but it wasn't always that. When she joined, it was a little teeny neighborhood organization. And her and John would come in on Sunday to board meetings and sit down and make decisions with all the workers who never had any political aspiration, with moms and dads and regular folks, as well as the kind of basic board that Access was. And I've watched John. I've watched him work really hard for community. And I thought, gee, he must be getting tired. And at one point, not this time around, but before, when he lost his chairmanship, I said, John, aren't you getting tired? Don't you think, do you really want to continue your work ahead of the committee? And he said, you know, I know where the holes are. By that he meant he could operate in any environment because he thought it was important. And he was going to go through those holes for regular people and make their lives better. I have watched families suffering from immigration problems. He's unified families in our community. He goes to every damn event. I don't know how he does that.
He's emotional.
He listens to what regular, powerless people have to say. Just like he listens to us. How many times has he said, tell me what you think? Tell me what the problems are. Tell me what to do. And then he doesn't go on and start talking. He listens to you. Because he seriously wants to make things better for people. I know very few people in this world who have done as much good. John, thank you. And forgive me if I call him the great one.
And our commander in chief has arrived. So, ladies and gentlemen, Debbie Dingell. It's not very happy with Mother Nature, but she is here. There's no person more suited to introduce the political icon we are honoring tonight than another political icon. And it is my pleasure to introduce to you our own eternal general, Frank Kelly.
How often does one get the chance to introduce one of America's all-time great public servants, who I have known as a friend since we were kids. How often does it happen that this man's father, who himself was a great and respected public servant, by coincidence was a friend of my father for a generation before our time? When you are famous as and well known as our guest, it's easy for me, because you and the audience and all who preceded me on this dais tonight already know of our guest's great accomplishments during a long and distinguished career in the United States Congress. You know his service on the powerful House Energy and Commerce Committee, which in addition to commerce and energy, has jurisdiction over matters of our national environment, health care, consumer protection, safety, and telecommunications. I was sitting with Tara White this evening, who represents the Michigan Association of Broadcasters, and she told me more than once what a great and strong voice our guest always was in the field of telecommunications on behalf of the public interest. Our guest led actions to toughen corporate responsibility and accountability before and after Enron and the WorldCom accounting scandals. He led the battle to pass revolutionary legislation. He was the foremost sponsor of the Endangered Species Act, America's first international wildlife refuge, as well as laws addressing children's health and the Mammography Quality Standards Act. He was a leader in ushering through the landmark Civil Rights Act of 1964 and 65. That alone should have enshrined him in history for all time. These accomplishments were proud moments for him, but of equal importance, they were proud moments for the welfare of all Americans. As a young man, he joined the United States Army at the age of 18 during World War II. Imagine going in the Army at 18, he went to a second lieutenant. I couldn't even make it corporal. After his military service, he attended Georgetown University for his undergraduate work and graduated from the Georgetown Law School thereafter. For a while, he was assistant prosecuting attorney in Wayne County, where I was the deputy sheriff, the local Barney Buck. We were in the same building together, and I was finishing up my pursuit of a law degree. But like my father, his father recommended that our careers be in public service as one of society's highest callings. And after his father sadly passed away while serving in Congress, my friend ran for Congress and won the seat held by his father, beginning his career on Capitol Hill. I consider it one of my great honors to be here tonight to introduce a truly great American to this audience, ladies and gentlemen, Congressman John Dingell.
And I'll tell you that story about you and the love that ever is the truth. She has so much respect for you, as do I. And you, Frank Kelly, are fathers were close friends, dear friends for a long time. They were back when the Democrats in Wayne County could have a convention in a telephone booth. And we proved that we could integrate the South as a society. We had an Irishman or Polack who got along pretty well. And Kelly, thank you for your wonderfully kind words. Thank you. And Lana, we've been good friends for a long time. You've been a great leader, and thank you for your kind words. Cynthia, thank you. I'm grateful to you all so badly. To all of you for believing some of these things, thank you also. Having said these things, I'm probably the single luckiest guy who breathes. I married Deborah. I've had a wonderful family. I've had a tremendous career. I've been able to have wonderful, loyal, good friends who helped me through all kinds of difficulties. It made it possible for me to do the thing that my dad wanted me to do, and the thing that I very much wanted to do, and that's to engage in public service. And one of the great things about that public service is that it doesn't have to be mean and nasty. On the contrary, it can be good, and it can be decent, and it can mean working together to make the country better for our people. And after all, if that is our purpose in public service, we're earning our keep. And we can go to bed at night and sleep and be comfortable in that we have done our best in the most important trust that the people of the United States can give us. My dad used to brag that the greatest job that the American people could give was a seat in the Congress. Because you are there, the highest elected, directly elected, constitutional officer of our country. And I want to say to my friends who are here holding elected office, we are indeed grateful to all of you, not just for your friendship, not just that you're here, but that you would undergo the enormous difficulties and challenges, efforts, and work that has to be done to solve our nation's problems. I think all of us tonight and for a good while have been saying about the way the country is going, about the way public service is doing, about the way that the Constitution and the truth and the important values of this country are denigrated, ignored, and demeaned by people who would win at whatever cost. I heard a fellow say recently, you know, one thing to all in this country is that everybody is entitled to their own opinion, but they're not entitled to their own facts. Important national issues. That's why we have Congress. That's why we have state legislators. That's why we have people who have the freedom to speak and say their thoughts and to have free media. So that this discussion can be meaningful and thoughtful and can lead us to the best possible conclusions and results for each of us and for our nation. We seem to have been unpredictable. It's my hope that events like this, or elections as that which is coming, or that which we just finished yesterday, will lead us to an appreciation that this great treasure which we have will be protected by us and by our successors. My old dad used to tell me, this was about the environment, but it's about everything else. You know, we do not receive what we have from those in the past. we inherit it from those who follow us, and we borrow it from them. And then it's our duty to return it to them in better shape than we found it. That's why it's important that we have people in this room, like you, Paul, or Greg Jones, or so many others, or you, Dennis, and your wonderful dad and family who served so well. Understand that we have a great treasure which we must guard and cherish and protect. When Ben Franklin was coming out of the meeting of the Constitutional Convention, somebody grabbed him and they said, "What have you done to us? What are we going to have? Are we going to have a democracy or a king?" He said, "We are going to give you a republic if you can keep it." So what it is you're doing here tonight is enormously important to you, to me, and to us, and in the future. It is of desperate importance. Now, why would that be so? Because perhaps the most fragile system of government is a democracy. And it's the hardest kind to protect. It's even one of the hardest to have people appreciate how important it is, and how brave it is, and how precious it is. Way back when the Norsemen did their business, they had what they called the thing. And that meant the thing which belonged to them. It was when they met to discuss the issues and come to a conclusion about what it was they were doing or should do or had done and whether it was right or wrong or not. And we all work together. I'm seeing signs that things are going better. And I'm seeing signs that people are really concerned about these things. Cindy, I saw when the unions made their negotiations with the auto companies, what a wonderful time they did, and what an act of real labor statesmanship that was. This is the philosophy that's so important to us, that we have this which we must protect and guard so that we can return it to those from whom we have borrowed it in better shape than we have gotten. You here in this organization have a particular debt of gratitude from all the rest of us. And that is, you are teaching us about history and about the importance of history. There's a guy by the name of George Santayana who made the observation, Richard's lying because I use this all the time, but that is that you have to learn from history or you're doomed to repeat it. And if you look back at history and see the jackass flooders, you understand the drives against that awful possibility is one of the most important tasks that we can have. For the love of God, let's not make the same jackass blunders our predecessors did. And if you look down in Washington, you'll see we're doing that on almost every day. And if you look, I think, in the state legislature, you see what's happening up there, and in the governor's and the president's office, he's an amazing citizen. They're a pastor of government. You've all got kicking the hands coming for this. But you hear the political history society tell us that it is important that we learn about this history, that we learn from it, and that we learn the importance of the system of which we are part. Michigan is part of the greatest nation in the world. It's a great state. And it has a history that of which we can be proud. It has given enormously to our country and to the freedom of our people. But more importantly, this nation is the most successful experiment in government in the history of mankind. And we're longer around and older and more successful than anybody else. That's an important thought
So you here in this society teaches not just what happened, but anybody why anybody in blockhead can look and see what's happening and say, there's three brothers out, I won't do that anymore. Or they can say, there's a better way of doing it. Or I want to do it this way or that way. But I sure as hell don't want to do it the way it was done before. And people can look and see what history tells us because they're the lessons in their minds on almost everything. So I say to you, not for giving me this honor, I say thank you for that. I sure can't say congratulations because Debbie's going to tell me this many I was pretty good at speech tonight. But I am going to say to you this. You are guarding and helping us to pass on the traditions and the intellectual treasures and wisdom that we have inherited from those who went before. One of the great things I have had in my career has been great people to teach me and serve as mentors and stuff. I've always been my business and try to watch and see how. That's a smart fellow. I see how he has to get rid of the problem. And I was walking to private chair and I said, you know, why is so-and-so doing this? But I don't talk to subject matter politics. I say, why in the hell did so-and-so do this? Well, the fact of the matter is, there's a new reason. And that's the kind of knowledge that would help us all in the state senate, the state legislature, who yesterday was here. I'm real proud of it. So, I think, as we walk out the door tonight, we can all be proud that we can get this kind of meeting and that we can help this kind of organization carry out this very important service for people, education, teaching us how to learn for the best. Having said that, thank you for God for giving me. Thank you for letting me have a little veteran of my beautiful young granddaughter here to join with you.
For our dollars in reserve so more people can come back and go to college. We did that. You know, after World War II, if my dad hadn't had the GI Bill, honestly, I don't know what our family would have done when he came back and was able to go to school. We did that. They fought that. The people who talk about patriotism and veterans fought that. We did it. We've increased support for military families. We've increased health care, both for physical and mental health needs. Democrats did that. And this last week we did something else. You know, everybody needs to be able to work, have a good paying job and a dignity of work. We have a lot of folks coming home who have served us, put their lives on the line, and they come home, and they don't have the ability to find a job. They can't find a job. And there's higher unemployment for our veterans coming home than for anyone else. And that's wrong. When a veteran doesn't have a home and is out under the viaduct, that's wrong. It's wrong for anybody. If you think about somehow morally as a country, people who put everything on the line for us. Last week, we did something about that. We moved forward. And I'm pleased that it was a strong bipartisan vote, but it was the Democrats who brought that forward, and it's part of the president's job bill that we actually got passed to focus on our veterans, to incentivize businesses to hire our veterans, increase job training, and also to say that if you have been using incredible skills in the military, whether it's a pilot or an electrician or somebody in healthcare, and you come home, you should be able to translate those skills immediately. Immediately, and not have to go through retraining. And we did that last week. Democrats passed a veterans jobs bill last Thursday. Democrats in the Senate. I have to tell you, one of the amazing conversations I had with a veteran from Michigan coming home from Iraq was he talked about all the people he had supervised and how they were rebuilding communities and everything that he had done. And he came back and sat down with a human resources person at a big company who said, "We appreciate your service, but have you ever had a real job?" There is nothing more real than what he was doing. And we need to make sure that every state licensure and professional certification recognizes what he did and allows him to come home and to be able to go back to work. Now that's just common sense. And it's the kind of ideas, unfortunately, that Republicans have been filibustering over and over and over. Three times they have so far blocked our ability to pass the President's American Jobs Act. So we said, okay, we're going to break it down into pieces and make you vote on each one. And you tell the veterans of Michigan and America no. Well, it works. And we passed it. And we're going to keep moving forward on every single piece to get it passed. Now, in my judgment, there are so many needs we have, but so much of it's wrapped up in the ability to be able to find a good paying job and to be able to have the health care you need and the pension security you need so you can care for yourself and your family and really have what we know should be available for every American. And so that's what I fight for in every capacity that I am involved in. I am laser focused on jobs and the ability to move our country forward. And frankly, I don't think we have a middle class unless you make things and grow things. And that's what we do in Michigan. We want, and I know that if we make it in America, the jobs will be in America. If we grow it in America, the jobs will be in America. That's where we need to focus. And you know, when people say, well, what is the Democrats done? I mean, we all know what the president inherited, 750,000 jobs a month. Luke lost when he came into office. We all know about the huge hole. I was there under President Clinton when we balanced the budget for the first time in 30 years. And then I watched what happened under President Bush when we went through all the wrong policies back into the hole, bigger hole than before. So it's a big hole. And we know we have to make tough decisions, and we are. But what I'm proud about with this president is that he understands the importance of making things in America. He understands when I put forward the Make It in America tax credit to make sure new clean energy manufacturing was done in America, he was standing there with me to be able to get that over the finish line 2 years ago. We've got 12 new Michigan companies and counting who are hiring literally thousands of people to build new wind turbines and solar panels and advanced batteries and clean energy technologies right here in Michigan. That's happening. They're beginning to turn it around. We're not there yet. We've got so much more to do, but we are beginning to turn it around. We have a vision. It's about incentivizing American jobs and new technologies and an energy policy that works, that protects our air and water and land, but also creates jobs. That's what we are focused on. And because of that, Michigan is now rated as the number one state for new clean energy patents. The number one state. Now, I tell you that because that means, and I'm not surprised, we're the folks with the best ideas. We got the folks at the university, we got the folks in small business, we got our manufacturers, we're out there creating new ideas. And if we continue to invest in the future, that's exactly what will happen. So whether it's the advanced battery efforts that we did 2 years ago that are creating new opportunities for us in innovation, and by the way, the national commitment about $2 billion, Michigan got more than half of it. Michigan got more than half of it, and I told the president that's the ratio we want on every federal program going forward. But we have seen the investments in the future in advanced data, the incentive to create clean energy manufacturing here, and an effort that unfortunately we continue to have to fight, which is to maintain retooling loans that have been used in Michigan, and I was proud to author in the last energy bill, that allow us to retool plants that have closed to make the new vehicles of the future. In Wayne, Michigan, Ford received a major retooling loan. They've retooled the whole plant. They're making the Ford Focus Electric as well as a number of other vehicles. And coupling that with the battery innovation, they are actually bringing jobs back from Mexico. And that's the direction we want the jobs to go. And the president has stood with us, has stood with me every step of the way. I didn't have to argue with him, as I literally did with the former president, that it was more important where things are made than just the price coming in from China. We are lucky to have President Obama on our side as we look to the future, and I want to make sure he has a second term. We move forward on jobs. You know, I said we got to make things here. We do. And by the way, when we look at all kinds of things that we make, you know, when folks look at a wind turbine, they see providing energy. I see 8,000 parts in one of those big wind turbines, and we can make every one of them in Michigan. So that's what I see. That's what I see. But I also have a hat where I'm now chairing the Agriculture Committee for the United States Senate. I'm very proud of that. And I'm working very hard to strengthen Michigan agriculture, increase our local food partnerships and local communities so our schools can buy from our local farmers, and we've got more opportunities for fresh fruits and vegetables in Detroit and Flint and our cities around the state, and we have opportunities to create jobs, continue to create jobs in agriculture. 1 out of 4 jobs in Michigan is in agriculture. 1 out of 3 in manufacturing. And one of the exciting things for me is bringing that together. And I just want to share one of the efforts I'm working on, because it goes to the fact that we can do anything if we put our minds to it. We don't have to accept this vision on the other side. We can, if we work together with new ideas, we can do anything and move our state forward, our country forward. There's something called bio-based manufacturing, where you use ag byproducts and you can use it to replace petroleum and plastics. We all want to get off foreign oil. We all think about the pump. Well, everywhere we are in this room, there's plastic. And there's petroleum used in plastic. And they started a long time ago, Henry Ford started back in the 30s, trying to figure out how to help the farmers, and came up with an idea of trying to get more ag products in cars. Fast forward to today. If you buy a great new Chevy Bolt, if you buy a Ford Focus Electric or an F-150 truck or a number of different vehicles that are on the market, you are actually sitting on soy-based foam in the seats. So if you get hungry, I just want you to know. But it's soy oil. Why? Because it's lighter, it's greener, it's made here, it's grown here, it's biodegradable, you don't need another big landfill. You know, and it's homegrown. So those are the kinds of things that I'm focused on. We've got more than 80 companies right now doing this innovative work in Michigan. And a lot more that can be done to create jobs. A lot more that can be done to create jobs. But we know we've got a fight ahead of us on every front. And what Jocelyn was talking about and Mark was talking about, and every level when we look at the values that we care about of opportunity and fairness and justice, community, the ability to give everybody a chance to move forward, for them and for us. We know right now in our state we have a fight on our hands. But we also, in D.C., despite in our best efforts, and we fight and we move forward, and we're doing everything possible to keep laser focused on what matters for every family. And believe me, I understand that. I understand. My whole family is here in Michigan. I've lived here my whole life, and I understand about your house being underwater, the credit card debt too high, and the income's gone down, and everything else that's happening. Even in turning around our auto industry, the sacrifices that our auto workers made to save those companies are very real. And we are thankful that they had the courage and willingness to do that. We know we are in a fight, but it is a fight we can win. It is a fight we can win if we engage. There's no question that every single day in Washington, the middle class, working people in this country are under attack. And the ladder that allows the poor among us to move into the middle class is being weakened, or they're attempting to weaken it every day. Now, what stands in front of them that blocks them is a United States Senate and the President of the United States. But they attempt to do it every day. So let me just remind folks what is at stake for all of us economically. Since 1995, the top 400 wealthiest people in the United States have seen their income go up 276%, almost tripled. The same time, they've seen their tax rates go down 39%. Those same wealthiest 400 Americans actually own more wealth today than the bottom 150 million Americans. That's wrong. No matter how you cut it, morally, economically, that is wrong. We have a different vision about what's fair, about how to move America forward. Now, we all want people to be successful, and certainly success must be rewarded. But what's different about Republicans and Democrats is that we believe that those 150 million people at the bottom ought to have the same shot to be successful as those at the top. No more special deals, no more special subsidies, no more skewing tax policy to the very, very top. That's what we are fighting for right now. Right now. And frankly, that's why the President and the Democrats took on the subsidies that the banks get for student loans. And we stopped that over great opposition and took $8 billion and moved it over to Pell Grants and student loans so more students can have an opportunity for success. So we display those values every day. And we're here today to say we've got to be strong and move forward in Michigan to make sure that our values are reflected in every policy and every decision. That's what we're here about. Fairness for everybody, justice, equal opportunity for everyone to be able to make it. And while we're trying to create jobs and strengthen the economy so that we can continue to move forward and move forward much faster than we are, they are fighting it every step of the way. And to add insult to injury, they want to give Social Security to Wall Street and Medicare to the private for-profit insurance companies and take the money to save and put it back into another round of tax breaks for the top 400 people. And we say, no. No way. Senior citizens, working families, students in this country, and frankly, small businesses trying to make it have sacrificed enough. It's time that those at the very top who have been blessed like everybody else for living in this great country, made a little bit of sacrifice and helped out a bit as we get out of this deficit hole. Bottom line, it's time that our economic policies work for everybody, not just the top 400 people, but everybody in this country. It's time that we do what the president has called us to do as a country, to out-educate, to out-innovate, to out-build in a global economy and create jobs in America and opportunity in America. It's time that we have an American energy policy that creates jobs while protecting our land and air and water. The Great Lakes are a part of who we are, and we will continue to protect them every step of the way. Today is about recommitting to the real American values. The real American values, who we are, the values that our veterans are fighting for. Our active military are fighting for every single day. Fairness, justice, community. If we mobilize around our shared values and visions and organize and get people involved and do just what they did last week in Ohio, we will have a victory. Yeah. It is time to engage Michigan. Let's go to work. Thank you.
And ways that we can engage communities in our work. Beginning on the values part, I want you to think about one thing as we go throughout this day and enter this new segment on values. And that is this. We're going to be talking a lot about what we can do to better communicate a message to the people of Michigan to get them engaged today. I think you got that. But the second thing that I want you all to know and to think about throughout today is what can you do personally as individuals to commit to engaging the people in your network for the fight that we have ahead of us. What will you do? What will you commit to doing? And the reason why every single one of us as individuals must ask ourselves that question is because, and I really believe this, if we don't take action to engage and fight back, no one else will. If you're not here today fighting and talking about how we fight, people who aren't here, who are outside, those are the people we need to engage, and we need you to do it. We need you to do it. No one else, can't look to anyone else to do the work that we know has to be done. And this convention is about helping you do just that. So with that, I want to introduce a woman you all know who's done so much to fight for a government in Michigan and a government nationally that reflects our values as Democrats. And that is the great Mrs. Debbie Dingell. Please welcome her to the stage. Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning.
All right, guys, now loud enough. We're engaged in fighting. Good morning.
Good morning.
And if Jocelyn's done a fabulous job of meeting us and getting us here today on Saturday with James Berkshire. Thank you, Jocelyn, for your leadership. I want to thank her for that kind introduction. When she tried to talk me into speaking, I wasn't sure that I was the right person to speak. But she knew that I had some very strong, intense feelings and was vehement about the need for this conference. And how important it was not just to talk about the issues,
but who should be part of it. And those of you who know me know if I care about something, I'm not shy about communicating about it. I believe strongly that this conference was important after we saw what happened last year. Not just the devastating loss of elected officials at all levels of government, which indeed did have very serious ramifications on the many issues and values we all care about. But why? What was the underlying cause about why there was such a low turnout? Let's be blunt. Last year, too many people didn't vote. But we need to look at ourselves and ask why they didn't. And I would argue that too many people didn't think that they could make a difference. They felt isolated and angry, and most importantly, they've lost that sense that they're part of the community. So when I heard about the idea of this conference, I thought it couldn't come at a more important time. 1 year away from an election that will impact the lives of each and every one of us participating here today. And I felt strongly that we needed to ensure that this be the most inclusive gathering of individuals we have seen. We are all familiar with the Will Robbins quote that I'm not a member of any organized political party. I'm a Democrat. But I think that we are in this party because we do have very significant things in common. We are part of a community with very strong values. This conference today needed to include the young and the idealistic, the seasoned and the realistic, the optimist and the pessimist, the city dwellers and the youthers, teachers, auto workers, carpenters, small business owners, students, job seekers, elected officials, and those that may want to run for office someday, seniors and caregivers, mothers and fathers, married and single, and culturally diverse, with white, black, Hispanic, Italian, Pole, members of the Jewish and Muslim faith, Indians and Asians, people of every race, color, and creed, because that is who we are. As we begin talking about values, I will give you my perspective about why it's so important. Two authors in particular have greatly influenced my life and my work. Some of you may have read them or studied a book called Habits of the Heart by a group of sociologists led by Robert Bellick. And it's a study that borrows heavily from Alex de Tocqueville, a French analyst of American society in the 1830s, who wrote Democracy in America. Both books observed on the danger of American democracy could crumble under the weight of individualism. More than a century and a half ago, de Tocqueville traveled this country and warned that Americans would give up larger communities and form little circles in which selfishness takes dominance over community service. He thought that the day might come when we would gather with people who think like us, look like us, and behave like us, and we would huddle in little circles, and the little circles would take the place of broader community. He warned about that in the 1830s. To the extent that the future feared by Tocqueville is the present that we are seeing as Americans today, we need to worry. We have a ring of little circles surrounding a core of other people's crises. In such a setting, too many are becoming content to fight our own struggles or watch others struggle, but we're not willing to say it's ours.
I had the privilege of being raised as a child of a community. There was a constant flow of Catholic nuns who not only spoke to me of community, but they demonstrated it. They showed me the importance of ritual and tradition. They were strong, mature, impressive women who didn't just teach me how to read and write. They taught me what it means to live in a community, helped me learn distinctions between rules and values, between the advantage of being served and the satisfaction of serving, the responsibilities we have to each other, and the importance of action. In fourth grade, it was Sister Loretta Lynn who took me to a migrant workers' camp in the hot months of summer, not just to see where the cherries we ate came from, but how the workers who picked them lived. In the fifth grade, Sister Pelosi taught me how to cook and sew, not for myself, but so that I could join her in cooking for others who did not have food and visiting the seniors who were widows and had no one to visit them. And a few years later, it was Mother Myers who took me to see Dr. Martin Luther King in Grosse Pointe, who was fighting for open housing just 3 short weeks before his life on earth would end. It was a community divided. To this day, I remember the feeling of that day. And it was Mother Maxwell who took us into the city after the riot in 1968 to meet other young people our age to understand how lucky we were and what was going on in the city so that we really understood what others were living. I will never forget those incredible women who taught me to stand up for what is right, not to be afraid to speak the truth, to remember that we are all human coming from the same Creator and equally deserving of respect. They taught me that faith wasn't just acts of charity, but that you can make a difference with activism and participation in the political process. So you can blame the nuns for me. But indeed, whether you learned it at a Catholic school or at a Protestant church, from a rabbi or an imam, we have all been taught values that lead us to commitment to equality and justice for all. Dr. Martin Luther King understood that. He taught us that we are intertwined into an inescapable web of mutuality. He knew that in our country, it is love and cooperation with our neighbor that makes democracy possible, gives it vibrancy, and opens it up to all those that are left out. And Tocqueville noted, in a democracy, good citizens are those who work together for the common good in order to prod us to a better future. Almost 180 years ago, Tocqueville said that there were 4 institutions that could nurture community and democracy: family, religion, political involvement, and voluntary associations. He picked these 4 as antidotes to the poison of individualism, because these settings housed the traditions of community. Here, those traditions could be learned and practiced and refined. He recognized the day might come that people might say, what difference can I make anyway? And that's why we're here today. What is the role of policy and government? How do we renew in each of us the passion that not only can we make a difference, but we have a responsibility to do so? Government at every level, from the precinct to the president, is being battered. People are scared, and they're angry, and they're desperate for answers and leadership and solutions. And while we all know we've got to reduce the government spending, cutting budgets does not mean we cut crime.
Reducing the role of government does not mean we reduce unemployment, homelessness, drug addiction, and cutting budgets doesn't address hunger, medical needs, or educational opportunities. I do believe we're at a crisis point in our society. Community and citizenship are being challenged in a society where people have lost a sense of connection. We're losing a sense of reason. The notion that our actions affect other people and their actions affect us. Our nature is to be most concerned about those issues that immediately impact our lives. The farther we're moving away from strong family and cultural traditions, the less people feel bonded to each other and that they even need to care. If we are honest with each other, there is a tremendous sense of social isolation and alienation from one another. I think that as a community, we must restore our sense of being citizens again, to belong and to become involved. We need to make the word community have a vibrant, nurturing meaning of its own again. The time has come to remind people that they do have to care about each other, to try to help, because if we don't, who will? Is the risk of not getting involved worse than the consequences of not acting? For every time we are faced with a situation where we should act and we do not, we lose a part of humanity. And as I write this, I look to Pennsylvania today, where responsible people should have acted, and you now have a state in crisis because those that should have spoke up didn't. So I would say to you today, this policy conference gives us the opportunity to reflect on what is the role of community and values. How do we ensure that everyone knows and understands that they are part of a community and that their citizenship carries with it certain responsibilities? As Democrats, we do have to address the challenge of maintaining individual needs and rights, but of recognizing the importance of the public good. How do we educate citizens to see how they are part of an interrelated and integrated community where one's action can impact one's neighbors, not only today, but one's five children's future and their children's future? What I wish for is a government which knows that its fundamental calling is to encourage what is the best in us. Former Czechoslovakian President Václav Havel once said, "The politics is not, as Americans have so often called it, the art of the possible." He observed, "Let us teach both ourselves and others that politics ought to be a reflection of the aspiration to contribute to the happiness of the community and not to the need to deceive or pillage the community. Let us teach both ourselves and others that politics does not have to be the art of the possible, especially if that means the art of speculating, calculating, secret agreements, and pragmatic maneuvering. But it can also be the art of the impossible. That is the art of making ourselves and the world better. That should be our motto as we try to bring about change." So as we begin this conference, I challenge us that if we can find a way to restore the way that people view themselves in each other and their community, we will become united in restoring one community. We have to help rebuild their faith in the institution of government, other institutions, and honestly, as Democrats, recognize the importance of religion in our community. A definition of faith is to have firm belief in something for which there is no proof. The Bible says that faith is the evidence of things hoped for,
and the substance of things unseen. I offer the biblical context of faith as the starting point for us to begin the restoration process. If we lose faith, then we lose the ability to hope. And without either of those two, we are unable to imagine our community or ourselves as any better than we are. Each of us has a stake in ensuring that we do not become wrapped up in our own heart, and to help others see that as well. If we can educate all people that they have a stake in the community and in the democratic process, then they'll want to participate. And not only that, they'll want to defend it. In Habits of the Heart, Bella observed, the menace to America today is the emphasis on what separates us rather than what brings us together. The separations of race, of religious dogma, of religious practice, of origins, of language. There has been so much emphasis recently on the diversity of our people. The time has come to reaffirm this fact. What has built our country is community. And that community is not dependent on government. It's dependent on the willingness of people to build together. For me, and what I think today is about, is to use the capacity of government and religion, families and associations to rebuild one community. And we have to stop blaming and delaying. When the eighth education system falters, too many don't accept responsibility for our children and our schools, but blame others. The fault is the teachers or the teachers' union. It's the school board that's wrong or the superintendent. When the healthcare system begins to wobble, they blame the physician or the hospital executive. And when the welfare system has challenges, they don't blame the architect of the system, but the welfare recipients themselves. None of this blaming makes any sense in terms of solving the problem. None of this blaming will make any difference. It merely lets people claim, it isn't my fault, it isn't my problem, it isn't our prime responsibility. And eventually, it isn't my community. All the social ills of the world are not our fault. But the notion that our community's weaknesses aren't our problem is unacceptable. They are our problem. An uneducated community is a hopeless base for success in the future. And that is our problem. When children grow helpless and violent, they are still children and still our problem. Healthcare systems that provide neither care nor health. Social services that are neither social or services. Transportation systems that do not transport. Anti-bullying legislation that offers religion as a moral cover for bullying. It's not okay. Aggression because someone doesn't share your moral belief. It is our problem. None of this blaming makes any sense. And merely saying that they aren't. Merely denying them doesn't change the reality. They are our problem, not somebody else's. To fight the problems plaguing our community, we need to stop blaming and start partnering with each other. Business leaders need to get involved with the multi-purpose collaborative bodies now planning human services. Corporate executives need to walk not only factory floors, but the halls of our schools. We need to invest less money in home security systems and more in nurturing our children. And we might even set a better tone for community if we would stop advertising on radio stations that carry convicted felons or white bigots who preach a gospel of self-centered greed, who blame the poor for poverty and for the sick and for their illnesses, who teach civic meanness instead of civility. And when we stop blaming others, we need to stop stalling. We need to stop thinking we'll do something to build community when it slows down at the office, when our children finish school, when the holidays are over, whenever, but not today. You are here today because you do make a difference, and you need to help others know the same. In the book of Genesis, God put the fate of the world into the hands of one individual named Noah. Noah's faith in the world and in himself made it possible for our world to endure. God formed a covenant with our world and placed his bow in the sky to appear in cloudy times and remind us of that covenant. That rainbow, made up of every color, is there to remind us as we emerge from dark days that we are all bound to one another, to all the other life on the planet. If we can help remind people of the difference, that one good person can make a difference. That covenant, that rainbow, includes all of us. We can succeed in restoring community. The rainbow isn't just a story of ancient times. It's as true as ever today. In the lifetime of those in this room, we've seen individuals such as Rosa Parks, Dr. Martin Luther King, yes, even Steve Jobs and Bill Gates, restore the people, remind them that there is a connection between us all and the power within. Ultimately, when people remember they can make a difference, they do. So today, Jocelyn Benson, Mark Brewer, and the strong team that they have are setting in motion a process for us to restore that sense of the community. It's why we're here. It's why we need to be engaged. And I'll conclude with Matthew chapter 23. For I was hungry, and you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty, and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger, and you invited me in. I needed clothes, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you looked after me. I was in prison, and you came to visit me. Truly, I tell you, whatever you did for these brothers and sisters of mine, you did for me. That is why we are here today. Thank you very much.
And are going to begin our values workshop. We have State Representative Maureen Stapleton and Mark Chott.
If I say Stabenow, you say now. Stabenow.
Now.
Stabenow.
Now.
If I say in hunger, you say now. In hunger.
Now.
In hunger.
Now.
If I say engage, you say Michigan. Engage.
Michigan.
Engage.
Michigan.
Engage.
Michigan.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
We are so happy to have you here and so grateful that we were able to have our Senator Stabenow with us and our DNC member, Debbie Dingell. We thank them for those encouraging, thoughtful words. There are a few of us who have been involved in putting this together. I'm just one of a myriad of teams that have tried to assist Jocelyn as we thought about how we re-engage, how we get folks back involved in a different way. And so we started conversations around the state about what our values are. We asked questions like, what does it mean to be a Democrat, similar to what Mark Bernstein's daughter asked. What does it mean to be a member of this party? What are the values that we stand for? What is it that we see as we move forward towards 2012? What are we willing to stand up for and say, this is it, we won't take it anymore? And so when we went around the state and we heard things, there were some common themes that we will hopefully be able to integrate into the exercise that you're going to do this morning. We heard equality. We heard equity. We heard justice. We heard people say, I'm a Democrat because the party accepts all people. We heard people say that I'm a Democrat because I was born that way, but the values of that party Bonnie are closer to me and what I believe in my life. We had some fabulous answers, and hopefully some of that will be integrated into, again, the exercise. We know one thing for sure. Without values and without a vision, there will be no victory in 2012. We have to have values, we have to communicate the values of our party, and we have to communicate our vision. And so I believe to you that with this, and it's a quote that's in your book, yesterday is not ours to recover, but tomorrow is ours to win or lose. Engage. Engage.
Michigan.
Engage.
Michigan.
Engage.
Michigan.
I'm going to bring to you now Mark Cotton, professor of law at Michigan State University.
Thank you, Representative Stapleton. Thank you, Debbie Dingell. And thank you, Jocelyn Benson, for bringing us all together. In 2004, an important conversation started in the Democratic Party. We had just lost our bid to the White House, to a president who didn't deserve a second term. And so we began asking ourselves a lot of tough questions. And one of the questions that we asked again and again was this: why did so many voters who said they wanted a party which stood for values cast their votes for the other side? Our speaker this morning, Eric Satt, is a friend, and he's one of a handful of people in the nation who have led this conversation to help Democrats reclaim the mantle we deserve as a party which represents the values of everyday people. Eric began his career working for the late Senator Kennedy. Starting in 2004, he began working closely with many of our leading organizations, the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, the Governors Association, the DNC. He's worked with House and Senate leadership, and he's worked with the White House as well at every turn, helping Democrats reclaim the mantle they deserve. And Eric is no stranger to Michigan. He has traveled hundreds of miles here in the state with Chairman Mark Brewer reaching out to faith communities. He was involved in Governor Granholm's re-election. He's worked with several of our congressional campaigns. In 2006, Eric was featured in a Time magazine cover story on the Democratic Party's success in closing what many have been calling the God Gap. Eric, we are delighted to have you here in Michigan again with us. We are eager to hear what you have to say. Please come and share. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark. I think my only regret with that is that my grandparents weren't here to hear it, because it would have made my grandfather proud and my grandmother would have believed every word of it. So it is a pleasure to be here, to be back in Michigan. This is where, if we can put up the PowerPoint, we'll move on. This is where I kind of got a lot of my start. We came in after 04, traveled all around the state, working with people, and you know, all of us outside of Michigan have seen the ads. We've heard Detroit is rising. I come here today, and I look at this packed house, look at all the people in the back standing around, and I think it's clear Michigan is rising, too. It's time to take back our values and start getting back on track. So I tell you what, there are people in the back. There are tables. There's room in the front for those of you who want to come forward. I want to start by thanking, it's been done many times, but thanking Jocelyn for her leadership on this, for creating a kind of values-based forum to ask the right questions and to get us focused on what we need for victory. What we're going to do today, we're going to break up this morning's session and lunch into several different parts. We're going to start with the first part, focusing on identifying and articulating our values. We're going to have a group exercise to get you to know all the people at your table and create a concrete deliverable from the session. We're going to have lunch, and then we're going to have the second part of the value section, which is going to focus more on the implementation. How do we communicate what the values that we've identified, and how do we put those values into action? Let me start by just telling you a little bit about who I am, why I do what I do, and what I believe. I'm one of the founding partners of the Liaison Group, which is a primary group that works with Democrats on faith outreach and communications. We also do a lot of work on veterans and rural side, but as Mark said, mostly we focus on articulating and finding the core values that make us what we are. Our founding principle is we believe that it's possible to align what's right with what works politically and economically, and that doing so is the best way to bring about real and lasting change. As I said, we work to help Democrats and our Democrats to articulate their values, to connect authentically with the communities we need to win. As our focus, and this is going to go throughout the day, we're going to be talking about different sides of how we communicate. What we do, we work on building bridges to moderates and conservatives and tamping down efforts on the right while also mobilizing our base and empowering people to act within our own base. We approach faith from a place of humility, and we do all of this to help make sure that our message is as good as our policy. We all know Democrats stand for the right things. We got to make sure that we're communicating that to the American people. Because at the end of the day, all of us in this room, and I know myself, when I go home, if Medicaid is cut, it's not going to affect me that much. If school lunches are shut down, it's not going to have a huge impact on me. As people have said again and again today, we are standing up for other people. It's what we do matters, and our outcomes matter. We work for a lot of different groups. You've heard about them. So let's get into what we're going to be doing today. We're going to start with the discussion on values messaging. How we do it, how we craft a values message. The first part, and I tell you, people didn't know what I was going to present on, but I was set up wonderfully by our earlier speakers. We start with, as Democrats, we tend to focus on the what and the how of what we're doing. We're going to spend today focusing on the why. Why is it that we're doing what we're doing? Once we articulate and identify those core principles that are driving us, the next step is being able to communicate them. And to do that, we've got to understand and focus on the people we are talking to. Because it's not about what we say, but it's about what Americans, what people in Michigan, what voters hear. As we do that, one of the most effective ways is focusing on people and principles instead of process and policy, which is often our default. And remembering, as we engage these communities, it's much easier to, as we say, to redirect the river than to turn it back. Find out what they believe and help take that belief and take it to an outcome that's one of our outcomes instead of telling them that they're wrong and they need to change. And finally, as we go, the last part of this morning we'll focus on it. Don't think like an elephant. It's about both making sure that the debates we undertake are framed correctly and that we don't accept the frames of the Republican side. So we'll start with the first question, articulating the why. Mark Bernstein had not seen my presentation, but he set me up perfectly for this first point. Peter says in the Bible, you should be prepared, Christians should be prepared to give an accounting for the hope that is in them. Good theological advice is wonderful political advice. Because what people want to hear is not necessarily what we're going to do or how we're going to do it, but why we're going to do it. What are those four things that are driving us, that are driving us forward? What are the values that they can connect to? Republicans have been very effective at doing this. That they have this thing called messaging class, where what they will do is they will say, what are the core principles that we support, be it values, be it, you know, family, be it life, whatever it is, and then all their policies, they think, how do we tie those back to the core values? They identify what those fundamental principles are, and then everything they say is tied and related back to that point. Because here's the truth. As hard as it may be for all of us in this room to accept, voters make decisions with their hearts and their guts, not their heads. You think about it, you think about how you make decisions, that kind of may make sense, but knowing my audience, there actually is good science to back this up too. Dr. Drew Weston, who some of you may know, he does a lot of messaging work. He got his start, he's a neurobiologist in Emory. and they tested it back, you know, in the Bush years, they were struck by the fact that when you look at voters, look at their policies, voters who supported Bush didn't agree with most of his policies. By huge numbers, they agreed with Kerry's policies, and yet they supported Bush. And so we're trying to figure out why is this the case. And oftentimes, Kerry's voters always knew what Kerry stood for. The majority of people who voted for Bush thought that he supported policies that were the top 10 most important policies in America. The majority of Bush supporters thought he supported the opposite side of the policy than what he did. And Drew Weston studied that they put people in a room, they hooked them up to all the machines, and so they found the strong Bush supporters, they found the issues they cared about, and then they handed them evidence to say, here's proof that the president doesn't agree with you on these things. And what they found, watching the brain scans, is people would wrestle with this, and the part of the brain was being activated with the fight or flight activation. As they were trying to figure out what to do with what they thought about the person believed versus what they were seeing the facts in front of them. And at some point, be it they just dismissed it, oh, that's just the New York Times, you can't trust them. However they got over that point and continued to support Bush, they actually, the brain switched and they got an endorphin burst in the brain. It went to the pleasure sector. So the brain was literally rewarding these people for putting the facts aside and going with their emotions. This is the way people think. This is the way voters relate. And people say, oh, that's not smart. You know, this is not the way we should do things. But when you think about it, in a representative system, it actually makes sense. Because when politicians stand up before an election and promise the world all the specific policies, no one knows what's going to happen once they get in office. It's actually a very logical way to choose elected officials to say, not what are the different things this person says they're for, but is this person like me? Do they share my values? Can I relate to them? And I'll give it a kind of final example on that. When you come, you know, those who have kids, you come home, kids run up, you know, their hands are, give you a hug. You don't say, oh, son, I am going to prove my love to you by making sure you have a good college education, and, you know, I worked so hard, and my wife, and my mother and I gave up X, Y, and Z. You don't explain all the things you do. You scoop them up in your arms and say, I love you. And that's how we've got to start engaging the American people. Now, I'm going to give you some examples here to put some meat on the bones of this theory of things that have actually, some examples of messaging. We'll start with Senator Obama. Senator Obama, 2004, the Democratic Convention, when his speech is a great example of communicating the why. I'll read it here. Alongside our fantasy individualism, there's another ingredient in the American side, a belief that we're all connected as one people. If there's a child on the south side of Chicago who can't read, that matters to me, even if it's not my child. If there's a senior citizen somewhere who can't pay for their prescription drugs, and has to choose between medicine and rent, that makes my life poorer, even if it's not my gender. It's that fundamental belief, I am my brother's keeper, that makes this country work. It's what allows us to pursue our individual dreams and yet still come together as one American family. Wonderful language, inspiring. It lets you know this is what this guy believes. You feel like you understand him and can relate. And you may notice he starts also by denying the frame that we have to choose between individualism versus community. He recognizes the value of it and then converts that right into supporting his point. This is what we should be shooting for. Sadly, what happens though, we get in the power, we get caught up with whatever, and things change. This is President Obama in 2009. Explaining his speech, articulating why we passed the stimulus bill. I'm going to read it quick to get through. Less than 1 month after taking office, we enacted the most sweeping economic recovery package in American history. The American Recovery and Reinvestment Act. The Recovery Act was divided into three parts. One-third went to tax relief for small business, 95% of working families, another third was for emergency relief to help those who have been born in the brunt of the recession. We extended increased unemployment benefits for more than 17 million Americans, made health insurance 65% cheaper for families relying on COBRA, and for the state local governments facing historic budget shortfalls that demanded As demand for service went up and tax revenues went down, we provide assistance, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. If you read this, the question, why did we do this? What does he believe? What is he even talking about here? He is giving a description of powerful, important things and talking about communities that we need to be defending. But it's all descriptive on the what. The why is gone, and in the process, we lose our connection. Another example, in defending the, this was after Senator Kennedy died, we were moving the health care bill forward. This is how we started the, renewed the debate on health care. An explanation of why we needed to pass the health care. Now the idea is very simple here. What my proposal says is that if you aren't part of a big group, if you don't work for a big company, you can be part of a pool which gives you bargaining power over insurance companies. It's very straightforward. Suddenly, just like federal employees, there are millions of them. So they can drive harder bargaining with insurance companies. You, as an individual or a small business owner, could be part of this pool, which would give you more negotiating power with the insurance companies for lower rates and a better deal. Again, it's totally a what. And you think about that first statement and how it connects, how it inspires, and the difference. This was the Republican response. And this economy, with this unemployment, with our desperate needs for jobs and economic growth, is this really the time to raise taxes and create bureaucracies and burden every job creator in our land? The answer is no. Much simpler, much more generic, and honestly, much more effective. I'm going to quote this next answer of mine because it sets us up for the next thing we're going to address. We need to flip the switch from uncertainty to certainty. It starts by making sure no one faces a tax increase and cutting federal spending. Again, very simple, very to the point. Of course, you know, the economic, we need to flip that switch. It makes sense. What's really ironic about this is what he's actually talking about is a two-year extension of the tax benefit. There is nothing that could create more uncertainty for business owners than having a two-year extension of the tax benefits, but he puts it really simple and in a way that many Americans buy. So, part two of the why is saying, understanding how we put it together. Policy, and this is where Democrats oftentimes get caught up, policy, the why, and the what, sorry, is complicated. It's nuanced, it has to be. Messaging needs to be simple. The why needs to be straightforward, it needs to be black and white. What happens is our two parties kind of both mix this up. As Democrats, we get the messaging part and we try to put all the what in it. We try to make it complicated, we try to make it nuanced. Unfortunately for our country, the Republicans get the messaging part better, but they apply those same principles to policy. And they just make it simple, black and white, when that's not the case. So when you're messaging, we need to understand these distinctions. We need to draw these distinctions between what we're actually doing and how we communicate it. In the Greek, there's a term that's called telos, which basically is, it's the bullseye on a target. So if you throw, you know, you throw your javelin or shoot an arrow, it's the bullseye, it's the target. And that's the point that as we're developing our message, we need to constantly remember, what is our telos, what is our goal in what we're doing? When we're being simple, what is it that we are trying to communicate? And on the continent, we're going to be talking a lot about the theories and applications of things. I want to put in one very quick upfront moral hook. I'll give examples of things Republicans have done, we'll show different ads, etc. We cannot become like them. That is not the goal here. Everything that we do, we have to do it right, we have to win, but we have to be honest, we have to be humble, and we have to keep it anchored in our core values. This is not about changing who we are, but making sure that Americans better understand who we are. So we'll go again, as we're talking about the why. Make it simple, make it easy. Audience participation here. And this is going to matter because if you get this right, your table will be the first one to be dismissed to lunch. So I'll do it by a show of hands. Who can give me the name, and I read it already, who can give me the name of the first economic recovery package? Who knows the name? Okay, over there, white shirt.
It's ARA.
Which was?
American Recovery and Reinvestment.
Okay, so you guys got the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, which is pretty good. I had to look it up because I couldn't remember, and it took the whole table support to actually get the word. This is what we called it, and so as we know, that's not memorable. It got renamed the stimulus package. Another horrible day, and it sounds like a punchline to the Anthony Weiner joke. And this is how people start to interpret what is a very good policy, but because of how we present it to them. Stimulus package holds horribly, by the way, as we know. Next one. Who can name, this is the second group to go to lunch, who can name Obama's health care law? Full name. Affordable what? No. Yes. There we go. Okay, that's number two. It's the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, because we had to explain everything that it was doing. Again, a room of, we're all Democrats, we all think it's a great idea, and we can't even remember what it's called, so of course, it got renamed. What's it really known as? Obamacare. Now, there is hope. As I said, Michigan rising, Democrats rising. What's the name of the current jobs package, economic package? Yes. The Jobs Bill, Jobs Act, exactly. And nice and simple, the American Jobs Act, what's it also called as? Oh, Obama's Jobs Bill. Nice and simple, you know what this is, you know what it's about, it's easy, people can understand it, and they know why we're doing it. So, once we start to get to core, we got to start, as I said, it's not about in any way changing who we are. It's articulating who we are. We start by making sure we know who we are. Once we've done that, once we've figured out our why, once we've delved deep, the next step is understanding the people we're talking to. I was speaking to a bunch of graduate students a couple of years ago, and one of them asked, and I've never been asked this before, they said, you know, I've got 2 years left in graduate school, I want to get into politics. What skills should I be working on to be better at politics? What's going to make me more successful? And there was a panel of three, and thankfully they started on the other side, and I was thinking about it for a while, and I was thinking of everything that I do, everything that I see, what works. And it struck me, I said, you know what? I've never heard this answer before, but if I could tell you one thing to work on, it's empathy. Because that is the most important skill in politics, in communication, and everything. It is understanding the other. Because communication is not what leaves your lips. It's what people understand when it enters their ears, when it enters their eyes, when they see it. And so to be able to move them, to be able to persuade them, to be able to call them to action, we have to be able to tap into the things that they care about, into their core values, and for that, we have to be able to understand them. Another way, oftentimes when Democrats look at politics, when we think about trying to convince people, we look at it as an argument. We're trying to convince them that we are right. We are trying to prove it. We're trying to beat the other side. I say look at it instead as a date. We are trying to woo them. It is a different process. And not a Republicans, when they date for a one-night stand. They'll say anything to get them home, and who cares whether it's true? Who cares what happens after? That's the way they do it. I'm saying date for marriage, but it is a long-term wooing process where when you go to a date, you're not trying to say all this stuff about, oh, what am I doing? I mean, it's what does she care about? What do you think? How can I connect with her? That's how we need to approach our communication with the American people. I'll give you an example of one of the things that actually one of my pet peeves. When right after 04, the book What's the Matter with Kansas came out. I'm sure most of you in here are familiar with it. The basic premise was, how can these people in Kansas be so dumb to vote against their economic interests? Don't they realize that Bush, everything he's doing is hurting them economically? Why are they not voting their economic interests? I just left working for Senator Kennedy. I'm working on it. I was working for Congressman Price on the Hill in Congress, where I'm standing there saying, there is not a single Democrat in Congress who is voting their economic interests. They're voting their values. They're voting their morals. Instead of condemning people for holding morals ahead of selfishness, come on, that's what Democrats are about. We should be applauding it. The problem is, we then explain to them how their values are better articulated and reflected in our policy, in our position. It's not that Kansans were stupid. It's that we failed to connect with them. And this is an important point to keep in mind. It's always easy to dismiss the other side. It's our job to connect. I'll give you my quick story. When I look back and say, when did I truly become a Democrat? I was raised a Democrat, voted Democrat. I went to the Hill. I ended up in Kennedy's office. But the point when I became a Democrat was when I worked on the Health Committee, which did health, education, labor, and pensions. When the doors would close, there was no press, and we'd go behind closed doors and start negotiating a bill. And everybody in the room just accepted the way that we would strategically negotiate with the assumption Democrats were looking out for workers, we were looking out for average Americans, for the parents whose kids were getting hurt by drugs, etc., and Republicans were looking out for corporations. When there was no press, when there was no skin required, that was the starting assumption. That was the truth, and when I came to understand that, I said, no matter what happens, no matter if I get disappointed with how Democrats are doing something, I will never leave this party, because at its core, that is the distinction. We are out for the little guy, we are out for the average person, we are out for the common good, they are out for the elite and the powerful. And that's what we need to communicate. So, empathy. Understanding the other people sometimes takes you a little bit out of your comfort zone. Case study, nuclear budget issues right now. The disarmament community has come to the very smart strategic recognition that we are in a historically unique point where, because of the budget deficit, we can go after the nuclear funding. Not because we're peacenik and we want to decrease defense funding, but because since cuts are going to be acquired in defense, cuts are coming. We need to be cutting the outdated Cold War nuclear arsenal so that we don't have to cut funding from our troops and creating the equipment and training they need to face 21st century threats. Great frame is one that works broadly, and the question is, how do we get it out there? What we did was come up with a television ad that you all haven't seen in Michigan yet. You may, as it expands nationally, but the ad is going to be running during the Republican primary. So our audience is the Republican people who are watching the Republican primaries and the political chattering class who will talk about this. And this is the ad.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
They did. We won. But some in Washington still want to spend $700 billion on old, outdated Cold War nuclear programs, forcing the Pentagon to go without modern defense programs our troops need to face 21st century threats. Tell Congress it's time we ended these poor peril nuclear programs. Our troops need help fighting terrorists, not Soviets.
So this is not your normal Democratic act. In fact, there are a number of people, and I'm sure probably some in this room, and I will be honest, even myself, who's not crazy about saying, hey, we should be funding, it's like, we don't ever want to say we should fund weapons, but we're not. We're saying cuts are coming. We should be giving our troops the equipment they need to face current threats. And what this does strategically is gives us an end to cut defense spending. Once you start seeing the $700 billion nuclear program that most Americans don't know about, and it's bigger than foreign aid, once they see that as a possible offset, once members of Congress say, hey, we'll just cut one of the $37 billion new nuclear subs we're planning to pay for these other programs we want, once that starts, it doesn't stop. And that's how we move the ball forward. So, as I said, it's all about the audience. You find yourself, you center yourself, you find your core values, and then you figure out how do you communicate to them. And again, it can often be hard for Democrats because we, you know, sometimes we don't understand the other side. Sometimes it just doesn't make sense. How can they be so closed-minded on this? How can they say these things that are so hurtful to people? How can they not understand how these policies just destroy families and communities? So I am blessed and honored. I've been married for 11 years to my high school sweetheart. We've been a couple for 18 now. And one of the things that got me through this, and I know some people didn't like the book, but early on, relatively in our dating relationship, someone said, I'm just going to read this new book again. I'm going to from Mars, I'm going to from Venus. And I grew up as a very, ivory tower. My parents were in academia. At the table all the time, they were asking me, you need to defend if you believe in something, you need to explain it. I am very much, if you know the book, a Martian. Practical, if there's a problem, I want to solve it. And my wife would come up to me, telling me about some problem, and I, okay, this is what we need to do. And it wasn't what she wanted to hear. She wanted for me to listen. And for a long time, I was just like, well, that doesn't make sense. You got a problem, why do you just want to talk about it? That doesn't help, we need to fix it. And what this book helps me do, and it's a good lesson for Democrats to understand, it's not that she was wrong, it's just that she went about dealing with problems in a different way. And when I understood the different way she was trying to go about dealing problems, so Eric's sitting here saying, she's got a problem, how am I going to fix it? Well, my thing was, this is what you need to do. Did that fix her problem? No. Because that wasn't what she wanted to hear. It wasn't what she needed to hear. It wasn't what helped her fix the problem. By understanding what she needed, I was then able to just say, disagree and listen and maybe ask questions and give her what she needed so that the problems and issues and emotions could be dealt with. And that leads us back to the Kansas issue again. All of us in this room, I said when we started, it's why I'm in this. This is not about us patting ourselves on the back and feeling that, boy, we took the moral high road here. We took a stand. We did what was hard. I stood up in that room and said something that no one agreed with. This is so good. I took a strong stand. Our job is to do things that will help the people we represent. And so we can never spend our time blaming the American people. As a party, if they don't agree with us, it's not their fault. It's our fault for not communicating and connecting with them well enough. And again, I'm belaboring this point because it needs to be. We will spend all of our time crafting the perfect argument. Figuring out, sitting at our tables with our friends and our insular community of Democratic activists. Boy, aren't you so mad at what they did? Yeah, this is awful, this is et cetera. How do we get them? How do we go after them? What's this thing? Can you believe this policy? And we can increase it by 70%, and they're only doing it by 20%. If a Democrat makes the perfect argument in the woods, and no one understands it, does he make it sound? And the answer is no. It's not about our arguments and what we say, it's about how it is understood. And to that point, again, I'm going to keep anchoring us on a moral compass here. There is an inclination there to then go, okay, well, we'll make it simple. And, well, this would work. We know this polling works. We'll just do something really simple. We do have to be truthful. But sometimes, again, making it simpler can actually be more truthful. Sometimes not telling them everything, not saying it's about the patient protection and the affordable and the second part, and just saying we're going to make it simple can help communicate. It can be a more true this because we're helping them understand what the bill really does. For an example of that, sometimes picture can speak 1,000 words, I won't articulate it. Too often, we are on the left instead of on the right, trying to explain instead of communicating what happens. Another example, and this is one where this is probably going to make some of you uncomfortable. This, for the New START debate, for those of you who are familiar with it, after the lame duck, we got slapped in 2010. New START was, one of the biggest continuation of our arms reduction treaty with Russia. The treaty was up for ratification in the Senate. We knew it wasn't passed. The new Congress coming in would never ratify. We got brought on to work on this campaign the day after the election. And we agreed, I signed up, I'm like, okay, let's do start stuff, I gotta figure it out. And I'm driving into work and NPR's on, and they're talking about the lame duck session. What are the key issues going to be talked about in the lame duck session? And it was immigration. It was the omnibus bill. It was raising the debt limit. It was taxes. It was all these things that were the priorities that we had to deal with now, because if we didn't, we knew they weren't going to be done. I don't hear new starts anywhere in that. And 30 minutes in, I'm in D.C., so it's a long commute. 30 minutes in, one of the panelists said, oh, and you know what? There's this other thing. There's this new START treaty that folks are talking about. We got to get it done, because if we don't get it done, it's not going to be done. But no one really thinks there's going to be the political will to do it. So we got involved trying to look at two different audiences. One, we had to create the political will to push this when there was a lot of other stuff going on. There was other things the press was focused on, et cetera. And we had to do that by having something that would connect with average Americans and break through. Sat down with all the incredible team people dedicated their lives to these issues, saying, okay, what's New START do? Why does it matter? What's the why? And they started explaining it to me. Well, the primary reason is, and I'll be honest with you, I heard it so many times, I still cannot tell you what the primary reason was. It was a policy thing that had to do with literally reduce the numbers, it created a strategic realignment that greatly reduced increased the time required for a launch and made preemptive strikes much less likely, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And they also said, later on, by the way, since Reagan's time in the 80s, we've had inspectors at every single Russian site inspecting their nuclear weapons. For the last year, all those inspectors have been pulled out. And so there's also a danger that terrorists could get a hold of these weapons. And I was like, okay, well, that is something I think we can make simple and straightforward and connect. And you're like, yeah, but that's a secondary issue. The main policy thing is this. And we said, but what we need to do is explain to Americans why New START matters. So we came up with a controversial approach, but it was one that ended up being named the most influential issue out of 2010 and helped turn this issue, along with the great work of the broader team, into something that was also considered. So as we got generals on board, we got faith leaders on board, Democrats became to understand this is something after a shellacking that we can beat the Republicans up with. And so you will recognize the beginning, for those of you who are proponents of political history, we redid Johnson's Savior.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 7, 6, 6, 8, 9, 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
In a world where terrorists seek to destroy everything we hold dear, Russia's nuclear weapons cannot be left unmonitored. For 15 years, President Reagan's START treaty ensured U.S. inspectors monitored Russia's nuclear stockpile. But last year, our inspectors left Russia when START 1 expired and the Senate failed to ratify the new START treaty. Now, no one watches Russia's nuclear weapons. Tell your senator, we must ratify new START now.
A slightly better feel-good ad. I want to move off that thing of that. Another one against making it simple, foreign aid. All these reasons to do foreign aid, and we decided to make it about a tithe of a tithe, a very simple message. And with that, we're able to tap into a huge faith community. You see the validators on the right. Just another example of the messaging. So we move from that. We understand the other. We understand our anchor. We understand the other side. Then we got to figure out how we move. Again, so often we try to convince them. We try to convince them why they're wrong, why that policy is not the right thing. And what I want to encourage us to do is not spend our time trying to convince voters that they should change, but trying to cajole them to come along with us because of what they already believe. You got to understand them, and then you redirect them, because no one wants to be told that they're wrong. If we spend our time saying, this is why these people are wrong, this is why these voters are wrong for believing this, this is why this community, this huge community is wrong for whatever it's doing, they're just going to say, this person isn't like me. Most people, the vast majority of people, are decent people who just want to do what's right. Our job as communicators and as a political party is to help show them what that is. And one of the ways we're doing that is we articulate who we are, and when we're calling out the other side, when you're pointing out a problem with the other side, or even with things that you know a lot of voters are getting on board with, instead of saying you're wrong, use their own values, show that mirror up to them on their own values. Because in the Bible, you know, in the New Testament, there's only one sin that gets to that penalty, and that's hypocrisy. It is an incredibly powerful political message, political attack. In our faith work, it is the only way that we will go after someone on their faith is when we call them out for what they have claimed to believe. In that example, we have another case study with Ayn Rand versus Jesus. Paul Ryan, we all know him. Architect of the Republican budget, also champion of the Tea Party, and a firm believer of Ayn Rand. This is the God's only party that's doing this. We've seen their budget. We have seen how godless that budget is. The, you know, Jesus in the Bible, he gives, in Matthew 25, we've all heard it earlier, there's only one time where he actually lays out the criteria that he will use to judge the world. For all the talk and all the focus on salvation is one time where he lays out the criteria that he'll use to decide who gets into heaven and who gets into hell. And it's whatever we do unto the least of these, our brothers and sisters. That, to me, is what the Democratic Party is about, and that is the antithesis of what the Republican budget was about. And so instead of saying, you Christians shouldn't be believing this is bad, etc., we just decided, let's put it up to them. Let's let them hear what happened. Let's put their own words. Let's let them hear who the founder of this movement is.
I am against God. I know that rule of religion. It is a sign of a psychological weakness. I regard it as evil.
Who is Ayn Rand? And more importantly, why has she had such a profound impact on Republican leaders, like Senator Ron Johnson, who called Rand's novel Atlas Shrugged his foundation book, and Senator Rand Paul, who said he is a fan?
You are out to destroy almost every edifice in the contemporary American way of life. Our Judeo-Christian religion, you scorn churches and the concept of God. Are these accurate criticisms?
Yes. I am the creator of a new code of morality and morality, not based on faith.
Rush Limbaugh called her brilliant, and Fox and Friends declared her movie a victory for capitalism. And as for the author of the Republican budget, Paul Ryan,
Ayn Rand more than anyone else did a fantastic job of explaining the morality of capitalism, the morality of individualism, and this to me is what matters most.
What matters most to you?
And what it does, again, this was targeted to a conservative audience, and it just asked the question, Christians, Tea Party, so as a Christian, this scares me to death. And as a Democrat, I can say, boy, so far we have missed an incredible opportunity. We cannot, the Tea Party does not believe anything that even conservative evangelicals believe. And Republicans are trying to smush them together, and largely because we are just simply ignoring that group or accepting their framework and attacking them. We are allowing it to happen. What we need to do is drive the wedge between them. You'll see some of the responses we got, very positive feedback. But to me, where I said this worked, Chuck Colson came out a week after we did this ad, did his own video condemning Ayn Rand. Glenn Beck, and this is a way, excuse me, I didn't have this talk show work. So Glenn Beck plays our ad. because we quote him on the website. As Glenn Beck said, I didn't read it. You gotta love Ayn Rand. She's great. We had that up on our website, the Republicans who support this godless person. So he comes on the show and he's gonna play our ad. He spends 20 minutes attacking us, why I'm, you know, just some liberal, secular, all these sort of things. They're all for the law. And then he plays the ad, and it is clear he has never listened to the ad before. Because then he finishes the ad, and he goes, well, you know, of course they're taking this the wrong way, and you know, that's not what Republicans meant, but Ayn Rand, yeah, she is a danger to Christianity. She is not someone we support. So he had this ad, and on his show felt he could no longer defend her. Chuck Colson came out, and then Marvin Alasky, icon of the religious right, editor of World Magazine, gave this quote, for nearly a decade, Democrats have sought a religious wedge issue that could separate big chunks of white evangelical voters from their Republican home. Now they've found it in a thrust into the social Darwinist, Ayn Rand underbelly of American conservatism. So, we get our why. We understand the people. We start to connect it in a way that they can relate to. Now, as we frame it, we've got to understand how we do so. And the idea is personalize it, folks. It's about people, not policy. Your stats, more stories. When I was in divinity school and going to our preaching class, I had a mentor. He said, the way you do a sermon is simple. Come up with 3 points and 3 stories, and you tell it. And people will remember it. And it's true. Those who go to church, you know, different teachers of different styles. They always wanted to stand up and lay out a very great theological treatise on everything, etc. And you go home, and the next day, you really can't remember a lot of times what they said. But the person that tells a good story, that can stick with you. Because that's the way people think. That's the way that we view the world and understand the world. Okay, it's a Democratic convention, so I'm hoping I got some takers here. Show of hands, I won't call anybody. How many people watch Star Trek The Next Generation? Pretty good. Not quite as much as I thought. Okay, now for the true Trekkies out there, how many of you know what the Garmok episode of Star Trek The Next Generation was? There we go, some good ones. Okay, you can learn a lot from Star Trek. It is a great storytelling episode. This one, the Garmok, it was actually the first, in my Old Testament class, this was our first class. Because Garmok, the very short version, Jean-Luc Picard, there's an alien race, they've been trying to communicate for forever, and they can't ever understand each other. So they show up to try to meet and understand each other, and the aliens realize the only way to do it is to put them in a thing where they got to. So they beam the car down to the planet. There's an alien on the planet that's really bad and trying to kill them. They put the air captain on the planet, so they have to work together, put a force field around, can't beam them off, etc. And the moral of the story is, what they find out is that the reason the universal translator that the Federation has doesn't work is because this alien race communicates only through stories. Everything they do is an allusion to a bigger, broader story that they know. So they will allude to knowing. I mean, everyone do know it. I mean, they will allude to these ideas, to these principles. They will allude to the settlers crossing America in the covered wagon. They will do these things that people can understand. They will tap those archetypes. And that's what we need to be doing. We need to be tapping these broader myths, these broader understandings, and personalizing it for people so that they can understand. Because when you put a face on something, that is how you understand the why. So, August of 2009, we've been rolling out the healthcare debate. The Tea Party has come up, and Democrats, Tea Party is taking off. Democrats are reverting to explaining why our healthcare law is a good law. And I see coverage of the largest free health clinic ever offered in San Francisco. People lined up for weeks in this giant parking lot, tenting and waiting to get access to free health care. And we said, we got to get back to the why. We got to put a face on this. And this is how we did.
For 8 days in August, thousands of uninsured Americans waited to receive treatment at a free health clinic. They are among the millions of Americans who wait for health care reform. They are not numbers or statistics. They are God's children, and they have a face. While the politicians bear false witness about reform, they wait. while special interests reap the profits of fear, they wait. While angry protest is silenced dialogue, they wait. In suffering silence, they wait for us to remember why we began the debate. We cannot afford to wait any longer. The time for health reform is now.
Now, you'll notice with that, nothing in there says what health reform is. It doesn't explain all the benefits to you and all these things on health reform. What it reminds people of is why we began the debate, why health reform matters, and it puts a face on the reason we should all care. That's how we connect with people. That's how we tap the values that every American has, and that's how we win them over to our side. Now, many of you, I'm sure, are familiar with his Ray Kauf's book, Don't Think of the Elephant. I want to take it a step further. Final point in our first part today is on the articulating our message is framing. It's not just about framing the arguments and picking them, though. For Democrats, we not only let them frame the argument, pick the ground where it's going to start. Oftentimes, we then start to view ourselves through the frames that they've created. We go even further in letting them pick the arguments. We start identifying ourselves through their arguments. Again, why we got to keep that moral compass, that connection on the why. What's our core? We cannot allow them to do that. Don't let them frame or pick the fight. Find your core why, find the thing that's driving your audience, and then work from there. Our issue, they call this an issues conference. This is a morals conference. This is a values conference. It's not about issues. It's about values. We need to turn our issues into values. 2006, huge successes. 2008, huge successes. In 2010, we're going around, and this is more on the state side of things, and I'm hearing time and again from Democratic leaders, oh, no, this election is about the economy, it's not about values anymore. Values? It's about jobs, not values? Oh, my goodness, folks, about jobs. What could be more of a value than that? I mean, whether a family can keep a roof over their head, whether, what the greatest cause of divorce in this country is financial concerns, what's harder on a parent than working two jobs, not being able to spend time with their kids just to put food on the table? These are values we're talking about. It's not jobs and these ethereal ideas. Values are about family. Other ones, I'm just going to run through some different ideas to set us up for what comes next. LGBT rights, gay marriage, we can talk about it as a right. No. People, when they see it as a right, it's something that can be taken away. Polling shows this clearly on marriage. The difference between saying, this is a right, something I deserve and I have and might take, is very different from saying, no, marriage is a value, it is a commitment, it is something of worth. We're not trying to change marriage. We want to be a part of this incredible institution. We want to stand up and make a commitment to this person we love for our life. We want to be a part of what you are. We're not demanding you change what you have. Climate, it's about God and country. Because we have a command in Scripture, be the stewards of our creation. The people who are affected most by climate change are the least of these, who are the least able to adapt. We all know the, oil, where we get our oil from, our money from China, to buy oil from the Middle East, that they know to put the bullets in the guns that are killing our troops in Afghanistan, both from the foreign oil and where we get it from, and then two, the CIA has said the greatest future threat America faces is from destabilized regions that are most likely to be destabilized from climate change and weather conditions. We need to be framing climate as God and country. Social services, and this is the point, getting at the core why. Touch on this a little bit. If I was going to articulate what's the difference between their worldview versus our worldview, they believe our neighbor is the problem. And we believe our neighbor makes us stronger. Think about that. Think of how it fits into everything that they stand for. It's about, they are saying America can't do it anymore.
We got to cut these programs because you got to hold on to what you get. Those poor kids over there, not under city, that's the problem. We got to cut. If the education, we got to cut it. We can't afford it anymore. America can't do this. School lunches, we can't afford it. All these things, everything they're saying is based on a sense of scarcity, not abundance, a lack of faith in America, and a sense that it's our neighbor that we've got to watch out for. It makes us weaker. Americans, American Democrats believe our neighbor makes us stronger. America can overcome. Thank you. If we come together, we've proven this time and time and time again, it's not about cutting, it's when we apply American ingenuity, American know-how, American values to problems, that's how we solve it. Second point. Spending cuts. Boy, we can indulge these programmatic things again. And it's about, oh, we've got to cut the budgets and all this stuff. And that. Spending cuts are about one thing. It's about firing cops, teachers, and nurses. That simple. That's what it is. It's not about this program. It's not about how we'll reduce funding by X number of dollars and this percent. It's about what they want to do is fire cops, nurses, and teachers. Boom. That's something people can relate to. The bullying issue is coming up, getting all kinds of attention here. It struck me on how so often when it's talked about, it's done in a frame of, oh, these religious people want an exception. We shouldn't make an exception to bullying for Christians. That's not what it's about. It's about Christian witness. It's about the fact, and obviously different people, you know, being on authenticity would be better at living this message than others, but this is about no Christian could ever stand up for bullying. You can believe what you believe, but no Christian would stand for bullying. We don't want to be saying, as Christians, we don't want to be saying this is what we are. That is not the gospel. That is not the Christian witness. And again, that's the message that most Americans, that's a Christian right, etc., can relate to. Entitlement, a horrible term. Entitlement sounds like some handout, and no one really knows what they are. Social Security, Medicaid, these are not things that we should pay to seniors to keep them out of poverty, etc. These are things that retirees have paid into their entire life. It's about honoring our debt and paying what we owe. End of story. That's what Americans can relate to, and that brings me to one other point. Not going to get into it, don't have time to get into too much. A theme that I would love to see Democrats picking up on more is honor. It is a forgotten American concept, and it is what the Republicans have been trampling over time and again. We say, oh, it's not fair, or they're not being truthful. No, they've lost their honor. When they say, hey, we made a collective bargaining agreement, but now we're going to pull it back. There used to be a time when a man's word was his bond. When they stand up on the Senate floor and senators say, oh, those stats that I was talking about, those weren't meant to be truthful, they've lost their honor. This is, again, a fundamental American archetype we can connect to, should more. I got warnings about bringing up abortion. I'm going to, because it's important and it's a good illustration. I'm not talking about reframing entirely the pro-life, pro-choice argument, but it's a great example of thinking like the elephant. They came up with pro-life. That was their term. They did it first. So, what did we do? We had to do something back in response. Try for a second to remove all the stuff that you know about these issues. What is better to be for, life or choice? As a concept, as a frame. And when you start with their frame of life, and then it's about choosing, it's about helping women choose not to do life. How does that work? We accepted their frame. We let them have life, even though it's just in Mississippi and elsewhere. They don't care. I mean, they're talking about things that are going to lead to death. And we all know that as soon as that baby is born, they can give a rat's ass. And so it's not about life. We shouldn't let them have it. And then what we're about, I mean, I say, we have a choice. We're about families. Everything we're doing is about family. Let's set up that contract. And as we talk, again, we're not going to change the terms, but as we talk about it, remember, as we're talking about things, we're standing up for women, children, healthy families. That's how we win on that issue. Taxes, the tax debate, real quick. Our founders left Europe to get away from aristocracy. Ever since the founding of our country, we have believed that America is a place where we value work over wealth.
Republican tax system is trying to change that. That's the way we focus on that. And final one, predatory lending. This is an issue I don't need to tell you in Michigan about predatory lending. The horrors that can cause, foreclosures, what that can do to families, destroying communities, etc. This is an issue we should be winning on. Ballot initiative, folks. We did it once, we did it in Oregon a few years ago, did a predatory lending ballot initiative. One of the things, thanks for so much money, that the truth is, like it or not, even good policies will get stopped because they control enough people on both parties to stop them legislatively. It's too hard to do. Ballot initiatives, people know that charging 80% interest on a two-week loan is immoral. Faith communities know this. There's tons of arguments to be made about it. We did that in Oregon. Republicans have been blocking the ballot initiative. Predatory lending. We create a ballot initiative on it. It's good policy. It's that example of aligning what's right with what works. And who are the people who are more likely to turn out for a ballot initiative on predatory lending? They're the people we need to be turning out. The Republicans in Oregon understood that so much, they called a special session of their state legislature in 3 months before the election to pass an emergency predatory lending law to get the ballot initiative off the rolls. This is a powerful point, and again, another way for us to connect with voters on what we believe. This is going to conclude part one. I'm going to put in a plug here, and we'll leave it up for the next section and then through lunch. Everybody here, there is a new resource out called Message Matters. I'm involved in it, but it has been, it's a creation, believe it or not, or you watch Democratic politics, you know about our party, you'll probably believe it. Democrats do not have any real common messaging documents for the day that we put out. We put out a common messaging guide. Media Matters, very well-funded organization, decided to fix that, and is creating now this Message Matters document. It's a daily talking point, four talking points, some background. It's all about messaging, our values on key issues. It's an invitation-only list. Right now, we've got most of the Democrats on and the Hill are on it. It started out inside the Beltway. The people we need to be using this, though, and the people who can use it best are you all. You're now invited to join. So email, stay up there, get on the list. You get an email every morning. You know, you can look at it when you want, but every day it'll give you a little bit of a frame, one more tool in the toolbox. So what we are moving to now is we're going to do a group exercise. And one of the things that Jocelyn wanted to really focus on in this day is creating concrete deliverables. And we're going to do something y'all haven't done before, and it's a little bit of a risk, but I think it can work. And what we're going to do is create a radio ad that is going to be run. We'll have the opportunity to choose it afterwards. You all are going to write a radio ad that's going to be run in Michigan. And the key, we're going to try to use all of these ideas that I've been talking about. So figuring out the why, articulating it, and understanding your community and pushing you a little bit outside your comfort zone, the ad is going to be run on Christian and country radio. So these are the people you need to figure out how do we connect with. Rural, regular Americans. What I will tell you is, if you can connect with people on Christian country radio, you can connect with everybody. What we've seen with this message is when we do it right, and I'll give you the best example I've ever seen from this state in just a second. When we do it right, it works across the board. It opens doors on the right, and it engages and mobilizes our side. So I'll give you a couple of examples of Christian radio ads. First one, I was given production and then a $2,000 media buy to try to get something on changing the abortion debate and try to push, throw it back to that pro-life issue we're talking about back in Memphis. $2,000 can hardly do anything. He said, you know what, let's do this ad and let's run it on James Dobson's Focus on Family Network. We'll run it in Colorado where all of them will hear and they won't know how big it is. We ran this ad, James Dobson heard it, he got freaked out, he then took the ad the next day, played it on his national broadcast twice, spent 30 minutes trying to explain to Christians how This is really compelling, and it might make sense, but you've got to realize who's out to do this. You can't trust them. Again and again, this argument sounds good, but it's leading to bad places. And so just give you an idea of one Christian radio.
With one in five pregnancies in America ending in abortion, and the number of abortions unchanged from 32 years ago, it's time to stop the political posturing and get serious about protecting life. 2,400 late-term abortions a year is tragic. But what often gets ignored is that 10 times more infants die each year in America, largely because of inadequate health care. We need to ask ourselves what it really means to be pro-life and help move the conversation beyond bumper sticker slogans. Thankfully, some lawmakers are already working on real solutions that will drastically reduce abortions by expanding programs that encourage adoption, increasing pre- and postnatal health care, preventing unintended pregnancies, and helping young mothers choose life. It's time for Democrats and Republicans to come together around solutions based on results, not rhetoric. Please learn more by visiting www.realabortionsolutions.org.
So that's one example. I'll give you another from your hometown. Those of you who listen to Christian Country Radio may have heard this a couple weeks ago.
Hi, my name is Tracy, and as a Christian of Terrence and an ordained pastor, I believe that every life is a precious gift from God. And I expect members of Congress who say they are pro-life to use their power to protect life, especially the unborn. I can't understand why Congressman Fred Upton is fighting to stop the EPA from enforcing its plan specifically meant to protect the unborn by cleaning up dangerous mercury pollution. Mercury pollution can have devastating impacts on the unborn and small children, causing permanent brain damage. And unborn children here in Michigan are vulnerable because coal-burning plants in our region have helped to raise the mercury concentration in our waters to threatening levels. Please contact Congressman Upton and tell him that being pro-life means protecting the unborn from mercury pollution. The Evangelical Environmental Network paid for this ad and encourages you to learn more at creationcare.org.
Now, the funny thing about this story, and boy, you go after Republicans on a pro-life issue and they don't know what to do. He called, his office called and threatened to sue us first. Which, now what? A political ad when it's totally political, that was their first response. And then we got reporters calling him, and their response was reporters calling about this issue. Well, people in our district, yeah, they're saying all these things, but I think people in our district care more about jobs. Brad Upton saying people in his district care more about jobs than life. It turned it into a national story in Time, elsewhere. He created a story out of this because he didn't know what to do when we went after him on his values. Final example from a good friend of mine, Congressman Tom Perriello, who's helped manage the campaign in 08. I'm going to talk. Our next section is going to be on taking all we've done and articulated and putting it to work. This is the more personal side of that.
I was raised to believe that a strong faith is a lived faith and that we will be judged by our fruits. I'm Tom Perriello, and I want my campaign for Congress to reflect those same values. That is why we're making a commitment to tithe 10% of all our volunteer time on this campaign to community service projects that directly serve the people of our district. I want to win, but more importantly, I want to ensure that my campaign reflects the values I hope sticks to Congress. The people of the Commonwealth should judge our campaign by more than just our words, and so I encourage you to find out more about our tithing initiative. We've already volunteered with Habitat for Humanity, soup kitchens, and the Emergency Food Bank. And now I hope you'll help us choose our next service project by visiting my website, gotom2008.com. I'm Tom Perriello, and I approve this message in hopes that you will join me in restoring America's tradition of service to our country and to our community.
Paid for by Perriello for Congress.
Okay, so what you all are doing now is you're going to make one of those. And you've got, there should be the guides at each of your tables. There's a primer at all of your tables that walks you through the steps of, do people have them? There is about to be primers at all of your tables. And actually, if the facilitators could help with that, We're going to be handing out primers to put at all of your tables. We're going to walk you through all the steps. Let me tell you the first one. Once we finish up here, you all are going to go around and introduce yourself and have someone set up to kind of be the lead, take notes on things. And then we're going to move, have a very brief conversation on figuring out what it is that you want to talk about. And do that, start with your why. What are the core things that are about, that are driving you? What's going to anchor this as? And then we're going to go to it from there. You'll have the next steps by that time. I'm going to leave you here with, and this is where I'm going to stop, the last of the language examples. This is from your party platform. And it's a beautiful example of the why. It's the preamble to the Michigan Democratic Party platform. There was a time when Americans were challenged to ask not what their country could do for them, but what they could do for their country. In recent years, however, we seem to become less interested in looking first to the needs of others, especially the needs of the most vulnerable, and more interested in meeting only the needs of ourselves. America's always been at its best when Americans ask not what's in it for me, but what can I do to get back. The Michigan Democratic Party understands this basic principle. That's why Democrats in this state are seeking the common good, the best for each person in the state, the orphan, the family, the sick, the healthy, the wealthy, the poor, the citizen, the stranger, the first, and the last. Seeking the common good is not difficult for Michigan citizens to understand. Just ask the woman who watches her neighbor's son so mom can work to pay her heating bills. Ask the pastor, rabbi, or imam who walks the streets at night praying for crime in his neighborhood to cease. Ask the dentist who keeps telling her, your staff keep telling her she's got to start charging families who don't have insurance. The people of Michigan deserve leadership with the moral conviction that matches that of the people of Michigan. It goes on from there. Now, I'm going to finish with, this, folks, is what they call a teaser. It's going to lead us to our next section. That was actually written by a bunch of pro-life, white, evangelical pastors who were engaged in a very successful effort of applying everything that we've learned today for what comes next. That's what we'll be talking about after lunch. So, I want you all now, introduce yourselves, get started with the radio exercise, and lunch is going to be available outside. We're going to be working through lunch, getting started a little around 12:15 with the second part. So, if everybody gets up at once, there's going to be a huge line. We have, who are the tables, first table? Okay, you all are first. Go on out and get lunch now. And then the second table will go after that, and then everybody else just take your time going up, spreading out, and then come back and we'll work on the desk.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you. I have a few quick announcements to make. As you go and enjoy your lunch, you can come back now for exercise. We'll have a brief exercise, and then two things I want to announce. One, there is a caucus meeting or a meeting in the governor's room, which is just upstairs, from 12 to 1, and it is the Michigan Democratic Women's Caucus Young Women's Leadership Training, so if you're interested in that, that's from 12 to 1 in the governor's room on the second floor. And then the second thing I wanted to tell you all is what we're building up here today is three things. We want every single one of you to leave with three things that you're going to be doing to commit to engaging Michigan. So if you want to get one of these now, basically you're going to write down what you'll commit to doing, what you want to do after this convention to build on what we've talked about to engage people in your network, and just fill it out and leave it on the table. We're going to get that to your county chair, and I will work with your county chair and with all of you to make sure that this happens. And he said, look, this is a great convention. It's great that so many people are here. We've got a day full of great activities. But at the end of the day, it's about what we will do after this day that matters most. And that's what this is about. So if you're not going to be here for the end closing session where we're going to talk more about action steps and what we're doing next, please be sure to fill out one of these before you leave and place it on your table. So finally, we're going to break for lunch now and go to the exercises or have the exercise. After that, at 1, after our exercise is done and we're done with the value session, at 1 o'clock we have a series of breakouts
each of which is named after a different value. And when you go to this breakout, you're going to hear your fellow Democrats talk about policy solutions that will further these values. We've got justice in room 202. We've got equality. We've got a panel on solidarity in the workplace, a panel on investing in our communities, and a panel on innovation. So we'll talk more about that after lunch. Please enjoy the lunch. You're welcome to talk amongst yourselves as we now begin this workshop part of the day. So Eric, I know it's coming back. So Eric will be back here as well to lead you through the next workshop, where you'll each be engaging in how to write a conversation or how to talk about your own values and your own story. So please take some time while you're waiting for lunch or while you're eating lunch to talk with the people at your table about your values. And I would like you to each answer the question, why you care, why you're a Democrat, why you're engaged. Share that with those who are at your table as we begin our next exercise. Thank you.